Welcome to Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Robin.
Chainsaw.
TK is once again unfortunately absent this week, but he assures me that he'll be back on the podcast next week. When it comes to horror movies of the 1980s, there are few that can boast the huge following that The Evil Dead has gathered over the years. And along with its sequels, Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness, I think it's safe to say that the Evil Dead franchise has proven one of the most successful in the annals of cult cinema. It's even getting a remake to be released really soon. Behind all three films is a man who has a big hit at the box office right now as we record this, Sam Raimi. And since Oz the Great and Powerful is raking in the money, Rob and I thought there was no better time than now to do a filmmaker retrospective on Raimi. So on this episode, we'll be looking at Sam Raimi's complete filmography from his low-budget roots to his massive blockbuster successes. Right after these messages. Groovy. The Back Row has a PayPal account. We're accepting donations. If you feel like throwing some of your hard-earned dollars our way, you can do so at The Back Row. Just go to the-back-row.com and click the donate button in the right column. If you donate, you can choose a movie for us to review and even specify which of us gets to review it. Doesn't that sound like fun? So send us a few cents and we'll review your favorite Sam Raimi movie. Shouts from the Back Row is available through iTunes. If you search the iTunes store for The Back Row podcasts, you can subscribe to our feed, which will not only get you your weekly dose of media culture from us, but also Tom Lando's all-original audiobook podcast series, Oathbreakers, and back episodes of our heavy metal podcast, Drop D Revolution, and our surreality podcast, The Tom Lando Files. Tell your friends and subscribe today. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I've caught up on a few movies. I finally got around to seeing Hitchcock with Anthony Hopkins playing Sir Alfred Hitchcock. I've been looking forward to seeing that one for a while, and I enjoyed this one. This is a very entertaining film for film buffs because I'm kind of a Hitchcock aficionado. I'm a big fan of the movie Psycho, so I was really excited to see it brought to life on screen. I know this movie was getting a lot of Oscar buzz at first, but it didn't get any nominations. I think the only one it got was Best Makeup, and I can kind of see why, because even though this is a very entertaining movie, it's kind of an inconsequential one. Like, there really isn't a lot of drama to it, because it's basically about Hitchcock trying to, get Psycho made, and even though he faced some resistance and had to mortgage his house, it isn't really treated as a life and death situation. Like, this isn't like, say, the movie about the making of Citizen Kane and stuff. Like, I don't think he was facing a lot of real danger, and it deals a lot with his relationship with his wife, Alma, played by Helen Mirren, and a lot of the drama is that he thinks she might be having an affair, but it turns out she's not, and that's kind of the least interesting aspect of the film, and there really isn't a lot of drama to it as well, and that's kind of why this movie probably didn't get a lot of awards. It's a breezy way to spend like 90, 100 minutes and stuff, but it doesn't really glue you to your screen or anything like that. But that said, it is a lot of fun to watch because of its attention to detail and some really great performances. I still think Anthony Hopkins really should have been nominated for a Best Actor Award at least, because he is just so dead on as Hitchcock. And I kind of like the way that they use like his image. Like, they have this whole subplot where they cast Michael Wincott in the role of Ed Gein, who is the killer who kind of inspired the character of Norman Bates, and they start off by showing Ed Gein killing his brother, and then Hitchcock suddenly appearing on screen like an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents to explain his backstory and how it inspired Psycho, and then having all these fantasy sequences where Ed Gein visits him in his dreams and stuff and kind of makes him think he's going insane, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff of behind the scenes making. I especially like the stuff where Hitchcock was dealing with the censors and how this is literally like Psycho was literally the very first film in history that was allowed to show a toilet on screen, where he had to argue that because Janet Leigh's character was flushing some evidence down the toilet, it was essential to the plot to include it in the movie, even though back then you were not allowed to show like a toilet on screen, which is unthinkable to think about these days. And it's a lot of fun just seeing them recreate like the filming of the shower scene and the big premiere where Hitchcock would not let people into the theater after the movie had started to like avoid spoilers and avoid the surprises getting away. And I love the climactic scene where he's just standing outside the door to the theater waiting for the reaction to the shower scene and seeing audiences freak out. It's a very satisfying ending to the movie. So yeah, I definitely would give a thumbs up to Hitchcock. It's not the greatest movie ever made about filmmaking, but if you are a film buff, you're gonna enjoy it.
Yeah, I totally echo all those sentiments. That's basically what I thought as well. A lot of inspired casting choices as well. I thought James Darcy really looked like Tony Perkins, and as I mentioned when I reviewed it, I also really liked Michael Wincott as Ed Gein.
Oh, and also the random cameo from Ralph Macchio playing Joseph Stefano, the screenwriter. I actually didn't recognize him. I had forgotten you mentioned him when you talked about it on the podcast. It was only after reading the end credits I was like, oh my God, that was Ralph Macchio. But he's entertaining as well. It's kind of funny how the screenwriter of Psycho was kind of a mama's boy himself, so he was the perfect guy to write this material.
And Michael Stuhlbarg as well. Got to give a little Stuhlbarg love.
Oh, yes, he was great in this as well. And another movie that I saw this week, which wasn't quite as good, even though I did not have high expectations for it, was the remake of Red Dawn. This is a remake I thought was not a bad idea for a remake, because I have to confess I'm not the biggest fan of the original Red Dawn. Like, I know it's got a lot of nostalgia value to it, because it stars like all these 80s icons like Patrick Swayze and Charlie Sheen, and it's kind of a time capsule of the whole like Red Scare paranoia, the whole idea that people were terrified that Russians could take over America. But looking back and watching the original film, it's actually like kind of depressing and dark, and that's why I've never found it too much fun. Like, I always thought that the storyline for it was like so absurd that they should have done it kind of more tongue-in-cheek, but since they decided to make the original Red Dawn like a serious drama, it became like surprisingly depressing, and it's never been a big favorite of mine. So I think that it was a good opportunity for the remake to improve upon it, but unfortunately it was even inferior to the original Red Dawn. This is about as generic and by the numbers as an action film can get, and has a lot of lost potential in it. I kind of find it amusing, the whole thing that because there's no big Red Scare or Cold War anymore, that they've updated it to North Koreans taking over America because they're considered the enemy. But it is kind of silly still overall. The film starts off well enough because the sequence where they're parachuting into this town and taking it over is pretty exciting and well done. But once they have all the young Wolverines beginning to fight back, then it really loses its footing. And I think the main problem with this movie is that it's just too short. It's only like 93 minutes long, and I actually, while watching it, was kind of comparing it to The Walking Dead, and I kept thinking that this would actually make a pretty interesting series on TV or a miniseries or something, because the idea of like a bunch of a lone band of survivors trying to fight off the North Koreans who have taken over America, because like that's a lot of material they can cover. But the movie just kind of skips from scene to scene to scene without any development or any backstory whatsoever. Like, you never hear a lot about how the North Koreans plan this or how they have managed to take over the entire United States of America. And you don't get to know the characters at all. You just kind of throw them into battle, and then some of them will get killed off, but you don't really learn to care about them. So like, this is a movie, this is material that could potentially be really interesting if it was spread out over 13 episodes, but because it tries to cram so much into 93 minutes, it doesn't really work at all. And the action scenes really aren't that exciting at all. They're too much shaky cam and too much quick editing. And it all builds up to like a really abrupt ending where it felt like the pilot for a TV series where at the end I was like, well, this could potentially lead to something interesting. I'd like to see more of this. But no, it just ends and it's just a very unsatisfying film overall. But I really wasn't expecting that much anyway because I know this movie, I think, was filmed like a couple years ago and kept getting its release date pushed forward. It's kind of funny. It stars Chris Hemsworth, and this movie, I think, was filmed before he did Thor, so it's kind of like Cabin in the Woods, where they got this unknown Australian guy to be the lead role, and it wasn't only, and both of these films didn't come out till after he hit it really big with Thor, so it's almost kind of like a retroactive before they were stars. So, unfortunately, a big thumbs down for the remake of Red Dawn. It had a lot of potential, but ultimately just fell flat.
It's sort of a similar situation, too, with the co-star Josh Hutcherson. This was made before he hit it big in The Hunger Games. So it's kind of like it was sitting on the shelf, and they sort of cashed in on the newfound fame of these stars. I have not seen the Red Dawn remake, and I'll even confess, I haven't seen the original either.
Oh, really?
And it's entirely because I'm not actually a very big fan of Patrick Swayze in general. Like, I've seen Point Break. I really like Point Break, but it's not because of Patrick Swayze. Likewise, I've seen Roadhouse, and I guess I kind of enjoy it as a campy film, but I've just never been a big fan of Swayze movies in general, and Red Dawn is one that I've just missed, because I don't actually know anybody personally who is like, oh man, you gotta see Red Dawn. It's the, you know, a classic cult film. And after the huge fiasco with the remake, I think it was made and then MGM went under and the rights got bought up by someone else, but they wouldn't distribute it unless, at the time when it was made, I think it was China were the enemies, and whoever, I don't know who the new distributor was, but they wouldn't release it unless they changed it from China, because they didn't want to essentially dump their Chinese intake, or box office intake. So they requested it be changed to North Korea, and it's all done digitally. But then you have all of these actors from different parts of Asia playing North Koreans. So, as I understand it, it still didn't do well in China. All that to say, and on top of that, I hear it's just not a very good movie. So, all that to say, probably won't see the remake of Red Dawn, and I still have no enthusiasm to see the original either.
Yeah, I know after I said that, it's actually really depressing that you're not going to go rush out to see the original. It does have a big cult following, but I've never really understood it.
I think I know all I need to know about the original. Wolverines, right?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, yes.
That's it.
And yeah, nothing else to say except that I'm really sick of remakes, and hopefully the Evil Dead remake will be better than this, but that's something to talk about later.
Oh, man, and I have so much to say about that.
Yes, but that's all I've been up to, so.
As for what I've been up to, I really haven't been up to all that much. I've been doing a lot of editing work as of late, and so the only movie I had a chance to see, and I'm so glad that I didn't pay to see it, was Beautiful Creatures.
Oh, boy.
What possessed me to see this? Well, Caitlin is always curious. Caitlin is a novelist, and she is very into young adult fiction, so she's always curious about fantasy movies based on young adult fiction that are that come out in theaters. Thankfully, she had no interest in Twilight. But she had a passing curiosity about Beautiful Creatures because with Twilight now done, you can see there are a few books coming out, or book-to-movie adaptations based on young adult literature coming out this year. One is Beautiful Creatures, another is The Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, and you can sort of tell that these franchises are trying to pick up where Harry Potter and Twilight left off. And so Beautiful Creatures is just the most predictable, boring piece of trash I have seen in 2013 in cinemas thus far. I guess it doesn't have all that much competition since we're only in March, but this one was just, it's so by the numbers, to the point where you can predict just about every story beat as it happens, almost down to the minute. For example, Minor spoilers for like the first 15 minutes of Beautiful Creatures. This really isn't spoiling much because I guarantee you've heard the, or seen this plot before. There's this guy, our main character, the protagonist. He's having these dreams of this beautiful girl that he has never met. Shortly thereafter, a new girl moves to his hometown and is put into his high school class. And she's not like all the other girls, and weird things start happening just after she turns up. This is all that stuff, again, very well-tread territory, but this is the moment. After class, after a weird thing happens, that is clearly the result of this girl, our protagonist is driving home in the rain. And as soon as I saw the shot of him driving home in the rain, I thought, okay, he's gonna look away and just barely miss hitting something or someone. And sure enough, right away it happens. He just barely misses hitting the girl, and that leads to them meeting and starting their relationship, blah, 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 blah. Really, really annoying. So predictable, really dumb, poorly acted. The main character, I should actually look this up before I make this accusation, but the main character really does not look like he's in high school. And of course I understand that, you know, they can't get young actors all the time, but this guy, Alden Ehrenreich, he was born in 1989. He really doesn't, he looks like he could not pass for a high school student, in my opinion, at all. I just found that really distracting the whole time. Don't go see Beautiful Creatures. It's really bad. I don't know. This doesn't give me a lot of hope for the Mortal Instruments, nor does it give me a lot of hope for future franchises based on young adult literature. I really hope something good comes along, something a little closer to Harry Potter than Twilight, because this is definitely the Twilight end of the spectrum. Big thumbs down.
Did Caitlin even like it?
No, she abhorred it. We neither of us liked it at all. Seriously, skip this one. I couldn't really find anything redeeming. The biggest insult, I should definitely mention this, the biggest insult about Beautiful Creatures is the main characters are growing up in this really small southern town where everybody but them is uber religious to the point where they ban books in the library. They ban all these books, specifically mentioned are books by Charles Bukowski and Kurt Vonnegut. Two of my favorite authors. And the thing is, like, if Charles Bukowski or Kurt Vonnegut saw this movie, they would just be appalled by the terrible writing that is just rampant throughout. And the thing is, watching it, even though, like, Slaughterhouse-Five and Bukowski, all these things are being name dropped. In spite of that, I did not get the sense that the screenwriter had ever read any Vonnegut or Bukowski. And, they quote little things about Slaughterhouse-Five and the works of Charles Bukowski, but all of the things that are quoted, they're the kinds of things, like, they're only the most famous things about those books. The kinds of things that you could read on the dust jacket. I was hoping at some point they'd whip out something really, like, profound and an interesting interpretation or an obscure quote. But no, all it is saying, like, I felt like Billy Pilgrim from Slaughterhouse-Five, who has become unstuck in time. That's, like, one of the first sentences of the book, and that's basically all it gets. So, in addition to the poor writing and the cliched plot and terrible dialogue, I was insulted because they thought to drag the names of Henry Charles Bukowski and Kurt Vonnegut Jr. through the mud in the process of this film.
If they were alive, they probably would have not allowed them to use their names in this film.
Yeah, well, I certainly hope not. Other than that, I haven't been up to much, but it occurred to me that I once again have been forgetting to talk about The Walking Dead, as I promised to do for all of this third season. It's losing me. It's really losing me. I haven't watched the past couple of episodes, and I'm not really enthusiastic to catch up with them, simply because every time an episode comes out, because I have been sort of burned by how awful and boring The Walking Dead has been at times, I often read reviews of the episodes before I watch them, just to get a sense of what I'm getting into. And Robin, are you up to date with The Walking Dead, out of curiosity?
The last episode, number 14, I haven't seen yet, but I did leave off with the one where the governor and Rick said they were going to go to war with each other.
Exactly. It was a whole episode of just them talking, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. When did The Walking Dead become a chamber drama? Yeah, that really just, when I read that, I was like, oh, man, we really, and apparently the episode that follows that is just like a prolonged cat and mouse sequence where Andrea finally comes to her senses and is stalked around Woodbury by the governor. All of this really feels like the kind of padding we were seeing in the middle of season two, where they were just stretching out the plot for no goddamn reason. And I'm sure eventually I'll watch these episodes, or, you know, maybe I won't. I'm going to watch the season finale, because I read somewhere that something like 27 people get killed. If that's true, then some of the main characters are going to die, because they barely have 27 people on the whole show. So, I'm going to tune in for that, because if it's going to be an absolute massacre, maybe that means that season four will have something cool happening in it. But I don't know, you know, I have my doubts as to whether or not I'll watch these next couple of episodes, or these previous couple of episodes, sorry, and that doesn't bode well for this show. Once again, you know, it's such a shame, because The Walking Dead video game series by Telltale Games is stellar. It is phenomenal. The Walking Dead comic books I absolutely love, but The Walking Dead TV show has been such a weak link in the entire franchise that I just find it so sad. And that's about all I've been up to. Last week, we both had contrasting opinions on Oz the Great and Powerful when we reviewed it. And we'll discuss Oz the Great and Powerful a bit more later. But in my review, I compared Oz the Great and Powerful to Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. And since I said that, I realized that in my mind, Sam Raimi feels as though he came from the same school as Tim Burton. They're both these horror comedy filmmakers who love camp and have their roots in the 1980s. Raimi and, you know, both of them, their early works especially, I am such a big fan of them. Both Burton and Raimi, all of their early films, I totally adore them. However, in my opinion, in recent years, more recently for Sam Raimi than for Tim Burton, they've been really hit and miss, really hit and miss. So all of that to say, I'm just really looking forward to talking about Sam Raimi, because he is one of my favorite filmmakers, and it does sort of sadden me to say that I feel like he's gone downhill a bit as of late. But yeah. Robin, I know he's one of your favorite filmmakers, too. Before we talk about his whole filmography, do you have any thoughts on just Raimi's career in general and Raimi as the director, the writer, the filmmaker?
Well, obviously, yeah, I'm a big fan of his. Like, I remember when I first got into the Evil Dead movies in, like, the early 90s and stuff. And he's kind of like Peter Jackson, where it's such validation when they reach such huge success and direct, like, these big, like, iconic studio franchises and find mainstream success. I felt the same way about Jackson, where it's like I'm used to seeing them in gory flicks, where it's like growing up in Orangeville, I was, like, the only one who ever watched these films or ever heard of them, so I always, like, championed them, but nobody had ever heard of them. And then, of course, like, Jackson does Lord of the Rings, and then Sam Raimi does Spider-Man, and it's so cool just to see, like, these low-budget horror directors finally get, like, mainstream success. And like you said, he has been hit and miss at times. Like, I think he's had a better track record overall than Tim Burton. Like, I like a lot more of Raimi's films than I dislike. But, looking over his filmography, I can't say there are any films of his that I really hate. Like, some are misfires, but, there aren't any films of his that have made me mad or anything like that that I thought are real stink bombs.
There's one for me, but we'll get to that.
Yes.
Yeah, and so if you could put into words, what is it about Sam Raimi that makes him so appealing to you?
I don't know. I guess it's just energy and stuff, like the fact that he was inspired by, like, the Three Stooges and stuff and tried to, like, put that slapstick element into his horror films and stuff. Like, that's the thing, is that they always move at, like a really quick pace. And, I was actually watching, like, a behind the scenes documentary on the Evil Dead 2, 25th anniversary Blu-ray, where Bruce Campbell was telling a story about how Sam Raimi and Scott Spiegel would just get together to, work on the Evil Dead 2 screenplay, and he could just, like, hear them laughing, like, nonstop from behind the door in the room and stuff, because they were just coming up with these really goofy ideas and stuff, and are thinking, oh my god, this is so hilariously goofy, I don't know if we can pull this off and get it on screen. But they do, they would try it, and that's what I like about him, is his great element of finding the most improbable slapstick humor and putting it into a horror film.
Yeah, that enthusiasm really does factor into my love of Sam Raimi as well. He's almost like every aspiring filmmaker's dream come true. You know, he's sort of like the guy who did it. He came from these roots of making Super 8 films with his friends, among them like Scott Spiegel and Bruce Campbell and his brother Ted Raimi. And they would just make their own movies for fun, just because they love doing it. And then they decide, well, let's try to make a legitimate movie. And so what do? They make The Evil Dead, and they drive out, literally to make The Evil Dead, is they got some actors and some low-budget special effects, and they just drove out to an actual abandoned cabin in the woods with a camera and, you know, just the bare minimum filmmaking gear. And they made that movie until they had destroyed the entire cabin and driven most of the cast, like, away with, in disgust or unhappiness. And, that sort of gritty guerrilla style that Raimi has, that's accentuated by his weird little inventive touches, his doses of humor, and, that unbridled enthusiasm. Those are all reasons I love him. I also really love him because he's one of those examples of, a filmmaker as a tormentor. There are these great stories about how on almost all of Sam Raimi's films, whenever a character in the film, like, has to be hit in the face with something, it's always Sam Raimi doing it. I think it's the beginning of Evil Dead 2 where Ash is being thrown through the woods and branches are hitting him in the face. Apparently that was just Sam Raimi whacking Bruce Campbell in the face with branches. Or in Spider-Man, where Peter Parker drops his books and gets hit in the face by a student with a backpack. Well, you only see the student from the waist down, and that's Sam Raimi's backpack being slammed into Tobey Maguire's face. So I kind of love that idea that he's, you know, he's enthusiastic, but it's almost like he's kind of dangerous too, I guess, in the way that the Three Stooges, you could consider the Three Stooges to be. So with that, let's get right into it. I'd say let's start with The Evil Dead, but perhaps Robin, you've seen his really early stuff, right? Have you seen It's Murder?
I've posted it on the back row. I did it before they were stars on it. I haven't really, like, watched the whole thing because, it's an hour long and it's really amateurishly shot. So it's tough to get through the whole thing, but, it is interesting to watch just to, like, to get glimpses of him, because it's kind of a murder mystery about a guy whose uncle is murdered. Sam Raimi plays his son or something, and, like, the family is fighting over the inheritance and stuff. And, it's interesting because, Scott Spiegel, his writing partner from Evil Ted 2, also has a role in it. Ted Raimi, his brother, has a role in it. And Bruce Campbell himself even has an early role in it. And even though it's not very good, there's actually what I admire most about it is that there's a climactic car chase, like, which is fairly well done considering, like, they were just a bunch of kids in Michigan with a camera and they were ambitious enough to stage, like a full-fledged car chase and stuff. So, I like watching that segment of the film. That's quite interesting. But, yeah, it just shows his ambition that even though, like, these were just a bunch of kids playing around, they wanted to try something, like, really wacky, even though it could have been potentially dangerous, and put it on film.
Out of curiosity, Robin, as a sort of aside, the texts that I have read on Sam Raimi's career, they're more focused on The Evil Dead, but I own The Evil Dead Companion, and also Bruce Campbell's autobiography, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor. Both those books talk a lot about Sam Raimi's early filmmaking, and I don't know, have you read If Chins Could Kill?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories about its murder, like you, I've only sort of seen it in clips. I haven't watched it all the way through, but you know, I believe it's in If Chins Could Kill that Bruce Campbell talks about how they just, like, they'd make movies any way they could. It's this filmmaker spirit and that this passion that we keep on talking about, where they'd find something, like, I think it was for It's Murder, they found big, what looked like wooden beams, but they were made out of styrofoam, and they just found them being sold at, like, a Home Depot style store. So they bought a bunch of them so they could break them over people's heads. Or how they spent a lot of time figuring out how to make a dummy that, you know, with hinges in the right places so it would look like a person when it got dropped off a height. And I think Bruce Campbell also has, like, the perfect recipe for fake blood that they used to use. I love all those stories. You know, that's all that stuff I find very inspiring. And so even though It's Murder and the short that followed it, Within the Woods, which we can talk about in a second, even though they are very amateurish, they're still the sorts of little filmmaking records that I really appreciate. I gotta say, I love that that filmmakers, even as early as the late 1970s, we started getting these filmmakers where their entire filmmaking career, even when they were making movies when they were kids, has been documented. I know that M. Night Shyamalan has a lot of his, like, home video movies that he made as a kid. I find those little sort of cinematic relics really, really charming now that these filmmakers have hit it big. And Within the Woods, of course you've watched Within the Woods, right, Robin?
Yes, I also have that one posted on the back row, and it's pretty much the predecessor to Evil Dead. It's only, like, I think, like, 40 minutes long, and they were hoping to, like, sell this and use the funding from it to make it into a feature-length film, which eventually became The Evil Dead, and it's interesting to watch, because you can see Bruce Campbell, he's not playing a character named Ash, he's playing a character named Bruce, and he actually gets, killed off, like, early on. He gets possessed by the demon, and I think the lone survivor is the character that Ellen Sandweiss plays. She was also would go on to be in Evil Dead, and she becomes the big survivor at the end. It's quite interesting that they were going to include this as, like, a special feature on the Evil Dead DVD, but I think there were some rights issues because they used some music inside the film that was, like, copyrighted, so they weren't allowed to include it on the DVD. So it's still to this day only available as a bootleg. Like, you can watch it on YouTube, but the quality for it is, like, really bad, but I still remember I used to order, like, VHS tapes from this mail order company called Revoc in Ontario, and they sold Within the Woods, like, all the time. I never did buy it, but it was still a hot seller because this is where Evil Dead originated, and even though it's really amateurish and the quality is poor, you can see the seeds being planted, so it's quite an interesting piece of film history.
Yeah, and even the part where Bruce gets possessed, it's almost like a precursor to Evil Dead 2, because they ended up having Ash become possessed in that movie as well. I remember, do you realize, Robin, that we are part of the last generation to remember a time before the internet was everywhere?
Yes.
I remember back when I was younger, I became an Evil Dead fan really early on. I think I must have been maybe 10 years old when I first saw it, and I just adore the Evil Dead movies. I saw Army of Darkness first, and then went back and revisited the other two because I enjoyed Army of Darkness so much. And I remember hunting for Within the Woods because I had read about it I can't remember where I'd read about it, but I remember reading about Within the Woods and going hunting for it and really trying to find it. And I didn't find Revok, which I kind of wish I had now, but I remember in the early, early days of Napster, I actually found a bootleg copy of Within the Woods. Somebody on Napster was sharing it, and I downloaded it, and I watched it, and I can't say as I was totally impressed.
No.
Because it is a pretty rough movie, and all the bootlegs of it are just terrible quality, like almost unwatchable quality. But I remember just being so proud of having found Within the Woods. And now it's so easy. A Google search, you can find Within the Woods. But I'm surprised that they never put it on any DVD version, because even if it had, you know, copyrighted music over it, one would think they could just put new music over it and ADR Bruce Campbell. I mean, it's not like there's a hell of a lot of good dialogue that would be missed. The sound quality of all the copies that I've seen is pretty bad anyway. But this is just another one of those sort of treasures from the early days of a now famous filmmaker that it's a lot of fun to look back on, especially because, you know, boy, Bruce Campbell he's gotten a lot older now, so it's really fun to see him when he's really, really young and just sort of a fresh-faced kid going crazy in monster makeup. So IMDb has a few other early shorts listed, one called Clockwork, and I know, of course, there are a ton of other Sam Raimi shorts. Have you seen Clockwork or any of the other Raimi shorts? I myself have not.
I haven't seen Clockwork. I have seen clips, though, of a movie called Attack of the Helping Hand. It's a short film that Scott Spiegel made that Sam Raimi acted in, and it's basically a parody of the Hamburger Helper commercials where, like, the Hamburger Helper hand just comes to life and attacks a housewife, and they actually cite that as a big inspiration for Evil Dead 2, and Ash has to fight his own possessed hand. It has a very similar slapsticky scene where, like, she's basically using every kitchen utensil to beat it off, and then traps it underneath like a tin jug and stuff. So it's only like 6 minutes long, and it's pretty entertaining to watch.
I should hunt that one down. That sounds hilarious. Okay, so now it's time for the big one. It's pretty amazing. The first major motion picture of Sam Raimi's career is still just like legendary. All these years later, it's even getting a remake. Like, it still has it has staying power. The Evil Dead. I don't even know where to begin with this one. Robin, I mean, do you love The Evil Dead? Of course you do.
Oh, yes. I'm going to tell my experience of when I first watched it, and this is hearkening back to the days of, like, VHS before there even was an internet. It was the early 90s, and I was really getting into horror movies and stuff, and I was reading all about this movie called The Evil Dead that was, like, a very low-budget film from, like, the 80s, but it was very popular, and apparently, like, Stephen King had been championing it, and to my surprise, my local Blockbuster actually carried it, and I remember being intrigued because it had the old Blockbuster youth restricted viewing sticker on it, so ooh, it must be really bad. And of course, it was something like a third generation VHS, like really crappy quality, but it kind of helped because it added like a low budget grainy ambiance to it while I watched it. And when I put it on, like, at that point, this was the goriest horror movie that I had like ever seen. It just blew my mind. Like, it takes people aback when they see it for the first time, because of course the Evil Dead sequels are like straight comedy horror, but this one is just plain horror with some humor in it. And but like, I had never seen anything like it before. And once I got to the scene where like the character of Cheryl just gets raped by a tree, I was like, oh my god, like, what have I stumbled onto here? And then it just got like so gory. Like, I remember like the scene where like Linda gets stabbed in like the foot by like a pencil, and then they just show the pencil like twisting right in and stuff. And it had like the really gory ending where like Ash is fighting off his possessed friends, and then their bodies fell over, and then their heads explode, and he gets brain matter all over his face and stuff. And I was also like really impressed with the camera work. Like, I had never seen anything like the long unbroken like tracking shots that like chased after them and stuff. So like, even though I didn't know a lot about filmmaking at the time, I was like, for like a low budget horror movie, this is really innovative and well done. So of course I became a fan instantly. And of course, not too long after that, I finally saw Evil Dead 2, which was a totally different type of horror movie. And, I loved it as well. But, I still have a huge fondness for Evil Dead. It's, of course, one of the most iconic horror films of all time. And I love hearing the story about it, that basically, like, they could barely get it released for like several years just because they didn't think anyone would want to see a film so gory. But when Stephen King gave it like a really rave review and they put his name over the poster, that like really intrigued a lot of people, and this became like success and like launched the careers of everyone involved.
Out of curiosity, do you prefer Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2?
It's a hard one because even though they're similar, they both have very different styles. I think I would choose Evil Dead 2 overall, but I like Evil Dead by itself just because it is like more of a straightforward horror film, and it was the first one I saw, and I still remember being blown away by the gore level for it and stuff. So it's like choosing between your children, but I'd give a slight margin to Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, Evil Dead 2 is probably my favorite as well. So, where should I begin with Evil Dead 2, or Evil Dead, rather? Fun fact, The Evil Dead on Rotten Tomatoes currently holds a 100% rating.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. Like, that is insane. I wouldn't say it's unheard of, but that is, like, stellar. That's basically saying there is nothing wrong with this movie. And I reading through the reviews, I really think that, well, I think a lot of these critics get it right, but Pat Graham of the Chicago Reader, his is one of the top reviews, and I love what he says here. Sam Raimi directed this 1981 horror feature fresh out of film school, and his anything for an effect enthusiasm pays off in lots of formerly inventive bits. It's, there it is, the anything for an effect enthusiasm. I love reading about the production of Evil Dead. You know, they made Hitchcock about the making of Psycho. I would love to see a movie about the making of Evil Dead. Certainly a lot more than a remake. Just because of the stories that you can read about in The Evil Dead Companion and If Chins Could Kill, how, like, they just went out into the middle of nowhere. It was freezing cold. The cabin that they had didn't have a cellar, so they had to just dig a big pit under the floor and make a trap door to go down into it. And then I believe they filmed all the cellar scenes in Sam Raimi's basement. By the end of production, they were just destroying the cabin left and right. The shotgun that's used was a real shotgun, and they just started shooting different props and filming it for the climactic final scene where everything starts exploding all around the main character. The branch that crashes through the window, that's not a prop window, it's a real window. So they were destroying that place as they went along, and they had to essentially rebuild it on a soundstage in a gymnasium for the sequel, because there was nothing left of it by the end. I hear that now there's little more than a chimney, because the cabin had burned down. They were just out there in the cold, dark night, filming, and a lot of the actors walked off, which is why like Ted Raimi is credited as a shemp, and a shemp is sort of like a Sam Raimi trademark now, where you have someone stand in for a character as their body double. They call it a shemp because that's what they had to do on the Three Stooges after Shemp had died. And so once the different characters start transforming into the Deadites, a number of them, they got, I think, Shelley, once she's a Deadite, I think she's actually Ted Raimi in a wig and just grotesque makeup for a while. Likewise with Hal Dietrich. And this went on until it was just Bruce Campbell left out in the woods with Sam Raimi and Scott Spiegel. And, I think Rob Tapert as well. And they were essentially just tormenting Bruce and recording it. Apparently at one point, Bruce Campbell, he stumbled down a hill and he twisted his ankle, and he tells a story about how he was cornered by Sam Raimi and Rob Tapert, and they just poked his wounded ankle with a stick and just tormenting him out in the forest. And, while I can't say as I ever want to have that kind of filmmaking experience, the fact that years later it has paid off to the point where there you'd be hard pressed to find a single negative review about The Evil Dead. It is the stuff of filmmaking legend. It really is. And just sort of amazing to think that it was his first feature that just shot, you know, he was off like a shot after this. a few other filmmakers you could compare that to would be like Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez, where they emerged fully formed, and their earliest features are still some of their most memorable. I really wanted to watch Crime Wave, which is Raimi's follow-up in 1985 to The Evil Dead, but I was unable to obtain a copy before this recording, so I have only seen it in clips. Robin, have you watched Crime Wave all the way through?
Yes, I have. This is not a good Sam Raimi movie. It's an interesting curiosity piece, though, and the story behind the making of this movie is almost more interesting than the movie, because Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell and pretty much everyone who worked on this movie absolutely hates it. But even though it's not good, it's not terribly bad either. It's just a big mess overall. This one is interesting because it is actually co-written with the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan. This was kind of a right after they had released Blood Simple, and of course the Coens and Sam Raimi are like big fans, so they kind of collaborated together to make, it's kind of like a slapstick comedy, like gangster film and stuff, and you can see like the Coen references right away, because the opening scene takes place in Hudsucker Prison, which is kind of a precursor to the Hudsucker Proxy. And basically it's about like this kid named Victor who has been framed for murder and is about to be electrocuted and stuff, and they have this very big backstory about him getting involved with gangsters and these exterminators who want to kill him and stuff like that. It's kind of a very complicated plot that doesn't make a lot of sense. And apparently the big problem with it is that, of course, Raimi wanted Bruce Campbell to play the lead role, but apparently the studio was interfering so much and wanted to cast this, like, unknown actor. I think his name is Reed Birney, who is really, like, not charismatic at all. Like, this film would probably be 10 times better if Bruce Campbell had gotten the leading role, but instead it's this Reed Birney guy, and Bruce Campbell is relegated to playing like a villain named the Heel in like a supporting role. But the movie, like, it has like it's funny scenes. It's very like has a lot of inventive camera work and photography and some laughs, but like the plot is just like all over the map, and I think it's because there was like a lot of studio interference into it. Like, they basically took the picture out of like Sam Raimi's hands and like re-edited on him and stuff like that, and it did not turn out the way that he wanted to, and there are a lot of like stories from the set of crazy things going on. Bruce Campbell talked about in If Chins Could Kill, about Brian James. He's like a famous character actor. He was also like in Blade Runner. He plays like the role in this as one of the exterminators. And apparently he went on this major cocaine binge and was trashing a hotel suite one night because he was convinced like that the ghost of his ex-girlfriend or something was trying to haunt him and was trapped in the light fixture. So here's Brian James on like a coke binge destroying all the lights in like the motel room and stuff. And you can kind of tell by his performance in the movie that the guy is on like some major cocaine here and stuff, but yeah, like the stories behind the making of this film are pretty much more interesting than the movie itself, but the studio kind of tinkered with it, and it was a major flop at the box office. It barely got a release and did not get good reviews, and Raimi pretty much washes his hands of this film today. He likes to pretend that it didn't even exist, and that was kind of like the main reason he went back to do Evil Dead 2. Like, apparently he never even wanted to make a sequel to Evil Dead, but because this experience was such a disaster to him, he pretty much had to go back and do it to kind of resurrect his career. But even though Crime Wave is worth watching as a curiosity piece, it is a big mess of a movie, unfortunately, and not one of Raimi's best.
I really only watch the clips for the Bruce Campbell cameos.
Yeah.
Evil Dead 2. Now, that's interesting that you say he had to go back to Evil Dead 2 to help resurrect his career, because I've read that he started writing Evil Dead 2 during Crime Wave out of enthusiasm for it. So I wonder which is the case. But either way, Evil Dead 2 is sort of this interesting anomaly where it serves as both a remake and a sequel to the original because they couldn't get the rights to the footage from the original movie to use in the prologue to recap it. So they just remade it and they cut out all the characters except for Linda and Ash. And Evil Dead 2, it really is sort of like what Evil Dead would have been with a bigger budget and more professional production. And as such, I think it's the superior film. It takes only the best bits from Evil Dead 1, condenses them into this little prologue, and then turns everything else up to 11, up to maximum, by cranking up the comedy and throwing in a lot of just slapstick and camp comedy into it, cranking up the cool factor. Now Ash is like a one-liner spouting, you know, wisecracker that has since become sort of one of the most iconic in the horror genre. And they gave him his iconic weapon. There's that great sequence where his hand gets possessed, which is like a showcase for Bruce Campbell's amazing physical comedy talent. You really believe that hand is, you know, has a mind of its own, especially when it's smashing plate after plate over Bruce's head. And then he has to cut it off, and he replaces it with a chainsaw, which I thought was one of the coolest things when I was younger. I still think it's incredibly cool today. I should actually give a little bit of background. I was one of those people who didn't see Evil Dead first. As I mentioned, I saw Army of Darkness first. And I actually found Army of Darkness in my youth through a website that's still around today, and it's been around for a long time, Drew's Scriptorama. And there was one summer where I had a really boring summer job, so I would just read scripts on Drew's Scriptorama. And one of the first ones I found in the A section was Army of Darkness. And, you know, young McGill, about 10 years old, thought that this just sounded like the coolest movie ever made with a title like that. And I remember on the first page of the script, it said, it described the opening credits as saying Bruce Campbell versus the Army of Darkness. And I remember being like, who's Bruce Campbell? And thus a fan was born. But I remember reading it, and of course at the beginning of Army of Darkness, Ash already has his chainsaw hand. So I was just totally in love with the character of Ash right away, sought out Army of Darkness, and then went back and watched Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. And Evil Dead 2 really is sort of the origin story of the character of Ash from Army of Darkness, much more so than Evil Dead 1. And I just, you know, I ate it up with a spoon. Every one-liner, every zinger, every shotgun shot, I loved all of it. And I still do today. I still laugh out loud with the sequence where the headless body with the chainsaw comes into the work shed. And it's obviously just a flimsy sort of puppet, but Bruce Campbell gives it his all in that scene. It's really something. All right, Robin, I turn it over to you. I've gushed so much about Evil Dead 2.
Well, like I said, once I saw Evil Dead 1, I instantly saw Evil Dead 2, like, within a few weeks of it. And I was just delighted by this film. I was kind of thrown off at first because you get the opening where Ash and his girlfriend Linda are driving to the cabin, and you're like, wait a minute, wasn't she killed off on the last one? And I was actually just watching an interview with Bruce Campbell on the Blu-ray saying that apparently when the film was released, people were confused and literally thought that Ash was so stupid that after escaping in the first film, he drove right back up to the cabin again with a new girlfriend and stuff. But no, this was kind of a bigger budgeted remake where we're like, yeah, we're just gonna run through like the first film in the first 10 minutes and cut out a bunch of the other characters and kind of give this whole a reboot thing. And but it kind of works with the tone of the film because like the first one was a straightforward horror film, this is a slapstick comedy, so it's kind of reinventing itself and kind of saying that this is almost the type of film we wanted to make the first time around. And like the slapstick in it is just like brilliant. and like I became like a big fan of Bruce Campbell instantly, because in the original film he's just kind of your typical bland like leading horror leading man where there's nothing that really sticks out about him, but here his like comedic skills really go into play and stuff, and the scene that really sold me on it is when his hand becomes possessed, and I love like how the corny jokes, like where he cuts off his own hand and then puts like a trash can over it and holds it down with the copy of the book and a farewell to arms and stuff. Like that's such a great sight gag and stuff. And I like how they play the whole thing from beginning to end. Like even, one scene that always makes me laugh is where the heroine Annie, thinks that someone's coming into the cabin and thinks it's a monster or something, but it turns out to be like the stupid redneck character Jake. And then she stabs him in the stomach with like a sword and is dragging him throughout the cabin while he's like wrangling in pain and like banging his head on the doorway and stuff. Like it's hilarious stuff. And I kind of like the way that they kind of evolved Ash's character, where he was kind of like a bland good guy in the first one. Now, and then he becomes kind of a smart ass jerk in this. And then by the time Army of Darkness rolls around, he's a full fledged jerk and stuff like that. So it's kind of funny how his character changes from movie to movie. But yeah, this is definitely the best, of the series overall, a slight margin over Evil Dead one, I say, but I think it's definitely the more popular one, because I actually know people who like Evil Dead 1, but then when they see Evil Dead 2, they decide they don't like Evil Dead 1 anymore, because it just, it's not as funny, and because they like Evil Dead 2 so much, it's just kind of like, the first one's more of a straightforward horror film, it's not as good. Evil Dead 2 is much better, but thankfully I don't feel the same way. I think they both exist well as their own standalone films.
Oh, likewise. And it's funny, you know, the Evil Dead, I really like because of the filmmaking side of it. Like, I like the way it's made. I love the colors of that old sort of grainy film. I love the low-budget feel, but, you know, accentuated by all these creative shots, this creative photography. I love that, and I of course I love the stories about it, too. Something I didn't mention was, you know, you're talking about these really long tracking shots and stuff, like the point of view of the evil force running through the woods that would become sort of an iconic Sam Raimi shot. I love it. It's just they put the camera on a board and they had one guy on either end and they just run through the woods and, you know, lift it up over the car and do all these interesting things. But the result is such an interesting creative shot. And likewise, they didn't have a dolly. So what they do is they cover 2x4s in duct tape and then smear the duct tape with Vaseline and run the camera along that. And it created those smooth sort of gliding shots. That stuff I love. Evil Dead 2, I love it because they took all the things that didn't work about Evil Dead 1, namely the cast of characters. You know, I love Evil Dead 1. All the characters are very bland. Their dialogue is very generic. Like, it's really very generic horror movie dialogue. And what did they do for Evil Dead 2? They took all that out, and now let's put in some annoying rednecks and an ambitious archaeologist's daughter, and let's do everything really crazy with Ash. And the only sort of bland character, who I believe he's the boyfriend of the archaeologist chick, or her colleague, I can't remember which, that's how important he is to the plot. They kill him off right away. He gets possessed by a deadite very quickly and is instantly more interesting. And they also, you know, turned the deadite in the cellar in. They brought in Henrietta, Ted Raimi, in this enormous, scary latex fat suit. And all the stuff with Henrietta is just so much fun. It really is just the very stuff that B-movies are made of. I love it just so much. Any other thoughts on Evil Dead 2? I mean, I could probably dedicate a whole podcast just talking about the Evil Dead movies.
I forgot to mention my favorite moment in the film was probably when the eyeball pops out of like Ed's face and winds up landing in Bobby Joe's mouth and stuff. I thought that was such a brilliant sight gag. And I was actually pleasantly surprised. Just today, McGill did a celebrity birthday of the day on Cassie Wesley, the girl who played Bobby Joe in that movie. And I never knew whatever happened to her. And I was shocked to find out that she went on to appear on One Life to Live, the soap opera, and was on the show for like 19 years. But throughout it all, everyone still remembers her best from getting an eyeball in her mouth in Evil Dead 2.
Yeah, she went on to be quite the soap star. One of my favorite shots really is Ash's severed hand giving him the finger. That's so funny. That stuff is all so good. Another great shot I love is where at the end, the bizarre, like, tree deadite creature with all the faces on it, I read that the gag was supposed to be that it had disgusting breath, but I never got that. I just thought it was, like, full of weird evil energy, and the shot I love is where you see a plant withering and a streak of white appearing in Ash's hair. That stuff's so good. And, of course, all this, the entire sequence where Ash assembles his chainsaw hand, the way each shot, like, zooms in hard on a different aspect, you know, the light being turned on, the rat running away, the chainsaw being uncovered, that whole sequence, having it end with, you know, Ash sawing off the barrel of his shotgun, putting it in its holster and saying his trademark, groovy. I love that stuff. It's so, so good, so good. I can't say enough good stuff about it. And it's great because there's plenty more Ash stuff to talk about.
I should also mention, I just looked it up, that it currently has a 98% approval rating on RottenTomatoes.com. There's one grumpy critic, I think his name is Pat Graham, who gave it a negative review, but otherwise it's all positive.
Pat Graham, you're wrong! You're wrong! So the follow-up to Evil Dead 2 was 1990's Darkman. And I remember seeing Darkman before I knew who Sam Raimi was. My dad had rented it and was watching it. And Darkman is really interesting. This is a film where Sam Raimi wanted to make a big screen adaptation of the comic book hero The Shadow, but he couldn't obtain the rights for it. So he made up his own superhero character, the character of Darkman, who could assume any identity with these masks he'd make out of synthetic skin, but the skin would only last so long and it would start to melt. So he had to live in darkness, essentially, to maintain his hidden identity. I remember just loving this when I saw it. Again, I was probably much too young to see this when I initially did. I think I must have seen it. If it came out on video, it must have been like 1991 or 1992. So I wasn't even 10 years old at the time. And I love the look of Darkman, you know, the sort of Claude Rains Invisible Man look where he's wrapped in bandages and he's got the black fedora and the black trench coat. And I just thought he was badass. And then years later, I revisit it and I go, Liam Neeson? What do you think of Darkman, Robin? What's your experience with the movie?
Well, it's funny. I never actually saw Darkman until, like, years, like, after it came out. Like, even though I had seen Evil Dead, like, I still don't think I saw Darkman until a couple years after that before I finally got around to it. And looking at it now, you can tell this is, like, a film that's, like, way ahead of its time. Like, if it had been released something, like, 15, 20 years later, it probably would have been a huge success because, basically, it was a superhero comic book film before those were, like, hugely popular in theaters. And then there's the casting of, like, Liam Neeson, who he was a fairly well-known actor at the time, but he was not, like, an A-list star like he is right now. So I can only imagine this particular film coming out with Liam Neeson today would probably be, like, a huge success. I mean, I think Darkman did pretty well when it originally opened, but it's still kind of more of a cult film than a big success. But it's a fairly enjoyable one. Like, I didn't watch it till a couple years after I knew who Raimi was, but I thought it still held up really well. Like, it has some, like, great set pieces, and it's very inventive, very well shot, and Liam Neeson is pretty good in the character of, like, this alter ego of a nerdy scientist named Peyton Westlake, and then this badass character named Darkman. He does it really well. You could kind of see that these are the type of roles he would be born to play, because I think he was mostly just kind of a serious actor up to this point. But it is a lot of fun, and even though some of the special effects look kind of cheesy now, it still has what I like most about Sam Raimi. It's, like, very energetic and shows, like, obvious enthusiasm for what he's doing. And even though I don't rank this amongst my favorite Raimi films, it's still, like, a pretty good one.
It serves as a good precursor to the Spider-Man films as well. You can really see, even though Darkman never was a comic before this movie, you can really, it feels very much like a comic book movie. And I think if you examine Darkman alongside the Spider-Man movies, you can really see similarities in the filmmaking style. I mean, obviously they're both Sam Raimi, but the way he's doing a comic book movie does feel very similar. And hey, Frances McDormand as well. You know, this sort of marks the beginning of where she really started to collaborate with Sam Raimi and also the Coen brothers. They all sort of travel in the same circles. I remember actually reading just today that Raimi apparently wanted Holly Hunter for the part of Bobby Joe in Evil Dead 2, which would have been really interesting as well. So, I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, I should also say things I love about Darkman. One thing that really stuck with me when I saw this, again, probably a bit too young to, before I really should have been allowed to see this, but the villain cutting off people's fingers with his cigar cutter.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that being very memorable and sort of burning into my young brain. And, it's still something that I think is highly memorable today. And Darkman, didn't it go on to have like 5 sequels starring Arnold Vosloo or something like that?
Yeah, it's true. It has a bunch of straight-to-video sequels with Arnold Vosloo, but I heard they're all pretty terrible.
So after Darkman was Army of Darkness, which, you know, it's sort of funny to think, Robin, which do you think is the most famous of those three? Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness. It's almost like, while they're part of a trilogy, each of them has their own big cult following.
Well, I have to say at first it was Army of Darkness, because I remember when this movie came out in the 90s, since this was a mainstream film, like released by Universal Studios, more people were aware of it. And pretty much everyone I knew in high school who had seen it had no idea it was a sequel to something, because, I mean, it has like a whole prologue where they go over the events of like the Evil Dead film. So it's like if you were to watch it as a standalone film, you would have no idea that this had followed up the Evil Dead movies, because it doesn't have like a number in the title. It's just a standalone title and stuff. So I knew a lot of people who liked this film, but I kind of had to introduce other people to the Evil Dead because they still had like a cult following, but they had not been released by like a major studio or anything. So only the most devout horror fans had even heard of those films. But as time goes on and stuff, Evil Dead has kind of built up more of a reputation since like Sam Raimi has become like a mainstream success. So I guess it is on these days, it is on equal footing with Army of Darkness, but back then in the 90s, like Army of Darkness was far and away the most well-known entry in the series.
Yeah, and it was the one I discovered first, as I mentioned before. And the same as the people you knew, it took me a little while to figure out that, oh wait, yeah, this is a sequel, and to go back and revisit or visit for the first time Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. Evil Dead is a straight up horror movie. Evil Dead 2 is a horror comedy. Army of Darkness is like a fantasy comedy. Personally, I find there to be very little horror in this at all. It really is just sort of straight up fantasy comedy. And it's great. This one has the best Ash, I think, of all three. Ash of Evil Dead 2 has the biggest transformation, and you can see him become Ash of Army of Darkness, but in Army of Darkness, he is just a wisecracker from the beginning. Every Ash line is so quotable. I mean, quotable to the point where Duke Nukem 3D ripped them off. And Hail to the King, baby. Give me some sugar, baby. These things are such a part of popular culture now that I think everybody knows them. But really, every line, well, hello, Mr. Fancy Pants. You know, I could quote Army Darkness until tomorrow very easily, because I love the campy fantasy writing. You know, it's even though it was made in the 90s, this felt like sort of the culmination of the 80s fantasy trend. And I love every minute of it. I really do. I remember when I was in high school, I became quite well known. It was in my, was it my 11th grade? No, it would have been my OAC or my final year of high school when I was in boarding school. And I became quite well known for my movie collection. And the school actually asked me to pick out a movie for the entire school to watch on Halloween, and I picked out Army of Darkness. And it is so great. Oh, man, if you ever have a chance to watch this with an audience, everybody just eats it up right from the get-go. Every Ash line gets a cheer. The geyser of blood coming out of that pit, it gets such big reactions. I don't know. There's just something so much fun about Army of Darkness that it hits all the right notes. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone who really doesn't like it.
Yeah, I had a similar experience in high school where I showed it to a bunch of people at my Halloween/birthday party one year who, they were not big horror fans, but they still loved this movie just because it was an hilarious comedy. And it's kind of funny how you mentioned that there's not a lot of horror elements in it, because to this day, Sam Raimi still likes to complain about the fact that the MPAA gave this an R rating, because he just says it's a bunch of fucking skeletons attacking a castle. You compare it to the Evil Dead films and it is really tame when it comes to violence and gore, because it's more of a fantasy film rather than a horror film, but it is a lot of fun, and I always like how it's kind of poking fun of itself at the beginning by the fact that it kind of rewrites the prologue again, where they actually cast Bridget Fonda to play the role of Ash's girlfriend Linda for 30 seconds on screen. It's kind of poking fun of the fact that they recast the role again just so they could kind of hurry through the prologue and the backstory and get him into medieval times. But yeah, this is definitely the best version of Ash, because he morphs from a bland leading man to a full-fledged asshole in this one. Because even though he becomes the hero at the end, he acts like a big dick to everybody, but you still like it because he's so funny, and he has so many great one-liners and stuff, and I particularly love the running gag where he has to uncover the book and he's supposed to remember the words Klaatu, Virata, Nikto, and of course he claims that he's remembered them, yeah I got them, but of course he says them wrong and then winds up causing all the trouble by all the dead coming back to life and stuff, and it leads up to an hilarious final battle with the skeletons. But there's just so many great set pieces. I particularly love all the miniature little Ashes who come and tie him up, and then he has the big confrontation with Bad Ash and then says, good, bad, I'm the guy with the gun and stuff. There's nothing, I can't think of anything bad to say about this movie. I believe you used it as your most quotable movie on our podcast about quotable movies, because it is definitely one of the most quotable movies of all time. And one other thing I find hilarious about this is the casting of M. Beth Davids in the role of the love interest, because she did this movie at the exact same time she was in Schindler's List. I find that hilarious that an actress could do Schindler's List and Army of Darkness at the exact same time, which is cool. So yeah, Army of Darkness, definitely an all-time classic.
Sure. I could have stayed there. I could have even been king, but in my own way, I am king. Hail to the king, baby. Oh, love it. Love it. It is the most quotable movie of all time. It's like that and Monty Python and the Holy Grail. That's you want all the best film quotes? Just look for those two movies. Now, that was apparently with the Evil Dead remake Inbound and Sam Raimi being a producer on that and apparently having a darn good time with it. He's been talking about doing Evil Dead 4, and I don't want to get my hopes up, because it could very easily be another, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull situation, where revisiting this beloved old franchise, even if you get the same director back, it does not necessarily mean that it'll be that great a movie, so I kind of hope that it doesn't follow up. But Army of Darkness, for now, the final Evil Dead film until the remake comes out, and still one of the best ones. It really is just so hard for me to pick my favorite movie of those three. They're so perfect as a trilogy, because each one is so different from the previous one that they all have different things to love about them.
You should mention that there's also the director's cut with the original ending where Ash sends himself too far into a post-apocalyptic future, which was obviously meant to set up for another sequel. But if they never do another sequel, then that's okay, because they wound up going with the happier ending where Ash goes back to his time and stuff. So it concludes the trilogy. So at the very least, if it had ended with that open ending and they never made another Evil Dead movie, then I'd feel empty. But it did end with the happy ending, so all is well.
Do you have a preference as to which ending you watch?
Not really, no. I think they both work well. I think it kind of fits Ash's character more, the darker ending, just because it just kind of fits that irresponsible jerk like that would wind up screwing up again and going to the post-apocalyptic future. So if they were to make an Evil Dead set in that future, then it would be the better ending, but unfortunately they have not.
Yeah, you know, I really do think either one works, and it does. That post-apocalyptic ending does fit with Ash to, you know, he'll never get home. Bad things just keep happening to him. But at the same time, I really love the happy ending that he gets where he blows up the Deadite in S-Mart. I should mention that on my desk in front of me right now, I have this collection of action figures that, all of them from movies that inspire me. And, I have three Ash action figures, and they're all from Army of Darkness. I don't think they've actually made an Evil Dead 2 Ash figure, but yeah, all the ones I have are from Army of Darkness. And one of them, the one that I think looks the most like Bruce Campbell, is the one where he's on the blue light special trolley from the end of Army of Darkness, firing a shotgun that still has its price tag on it. So anyway, I love all that stuff, in case you couldn't tell by now. After Army of Darkness, Sam Raimi made The Quick and the Dead. He decided to do a Western. And, you know, let it never be said that Sam Raimi has been married to a single genre. He obviously loves genre cinema, but he has certainly hopped from genre to genre over the course of his career. I really like The Quick and the Dead. What do you think of it, Robin?
I'm not a big fan of it. I have to confess I've only seen it once, and that was maybe back in like the late 90s, and this is when I become like a Sam Raimi fan, so I was pretty disappointed in it, and I think it might have to do with the fact that I believe this was based on like someone else's script, that Raimi himself didn't write it. Like, he has a lot of cool gunfights in it, but I still think that Sharon Stone is like really miscast in her leading role. I like the idea that they were trying to do, like, instead of a man with no name, doing like a lady with no name type of thing, but I don't think she was the right actress to pick. But the movie certainly has like an interesting cast. Like, Gene Hackman's a pretty good villain, and it's interesting to see Russell Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio. Like, they weren't unknowns at the time, but they were nowhere near as famous as they are these days, so it was kind of an interesting early roles for them. And there is a really cool like cast of character actors. Like, you have guys like Robert Blossom and Lance Henriksen and Keith David. And I think Tobin Bell even has, like, a small role in it earlier on. But throughout it all, I was just kind of expecting, like, a whole lot more. I would almost like to see Sam Raimi, like, direct, like, another Western himself. Almost maybe do, like, a screen version of Briscoe County Jr. and reunite with Bruce Campbell again. That would be kind of cool. But this kind of, I always felt was kind of mediocre, unfortunately.
Oh, man, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, Sharon Stone is the worst part of it, and sadly she is the main character, but the supporting cast is so good. You know, I really love the just the idea of doing this Western where the whole point of it is to have this interesting cast of characters, and they're just all in town to have a series of gunfights. I think this is one of those rare cases where a tournament movie really works well. I thought it really worked well as a tournament film. You mentioned most of the great side characters. Leonardo DiCaprio is great in this, I thought. Russell Crowe, you know, I'm not a huge Russell Crowe fan, but I really liked him as the preacher, Court. This is a rare case where, another rare case where I think he was very, very well used. I love Keith David. I love Lance Henriksen. Lance Henriksen is Ace Hanlon, who is apparently just full of shit. Like, he's the celebrity gunfighter, but apparently he's a sham. Tobin Bell. Let's not forget Sven Ole Thorsen, yeah, as good son, Swedish champion. Gary Sinise as the marshal, only seen in flashbacks. And I think that this is actually a really awesome role for Mark Boone Jr. as the character Scars. He is, like, practically unrecognizable under all this scarred makeup and, like, the one bad eye contact that they put in him, but he makes just such a great, despicable character. He maybe has a total of 5 lines throughout the whole thing, but I just love how gross and awesome he looks in that makeup. The gunfight sequences, they do have, like, you can watch those and still feel all those great Sam Raimi touches, the fast zooms, the POV shots, and I love This is the kind of thing where you can really tell that Sam Raimi was like, ooh, I got an idea. I want to do it. The idea of shooting someone and then having sunlight shine through the bullet hole. I love that. I thought that was just so cool. Overall, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I would not call this a masterpiece, but I really like just this sort of campy Western. I like the look of it. And I love Leonardo DiCaprio in the role of Kid. I think he is just terrific here. I should also say, something I've always loved about Westerns, this is something that I realized, and I couldn't tell you why I like it, but I love scenes in gun shops where a character is like testing out guns and looking at all the different old models of six-shooter. In The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, there's a great scene where Eli Wallach's character Tuco goes to a gun shop and spends quite a long bit of time assembling his own gun and, you know, checking the barrel and examining the cylinder and all that. And then he goes and tests it out on a shooting range. That sequence is one of my favorites in the movie. And the one in The Quick and the Dead where Gene Hackman is buying Russell Crowe a gun so he could compete in the tournament, that whole sequence I just love, where the kid is just running down all the different cool makes of old six-shooters that he has, and Court is picking up and testing each one. And Russell Crowe actually learned all the gun-twirling tricks, so you get to watch him do some really cool gun twirls and flourishes, and it's actually Russell Crowe doing them. So, I enjoy all that stuff. I don't know if I'd put this close to the top of my favorite Sam Raimi films, but I actually really enjoy this one. Now, after The Quick and the Dead, Raimi took a break for another 3 years, and he came back with Simple Plan, and this is actually one of the few holes in my Sam Raimi filmography that I haven't seen a Simple Plan, but I've heard it's actually quite good. Robin, have you seen this one?
Oh, yes. This is definitely one of my favorite Raimi films, and I'm actually surprised you haven't seen it. But then again, this is unlike any other film in Sam Raimi's filmography. Like, this is definitely the darkest, most downbeat film he ever made. Like, watching it, you would never recognize that this is the from the same guy who made, like, the Evil Dead series. But it's a really strong and powerful movie. It covers one of the themes I love, where basically normal, everyday people who are pushed into doing, like, bad things. Like, it has just a very simple storyline where Bill Paxton and his brother Billy Bob Thornton find a down plane full of money, and then they decide they're going to keep it over the winter, and if nobody comes to claim it, then they're going to keep it. But of course, they've got this like dumb guy hanging out with them named Lou, who is like a total career fuck up, and of course everything like starts going wrong, and like these otherwise ordinary everyday characters wind up doing like horribly illegal things, which is pretty fascinating just to see like how far these ordinarily good characters can go just out of greed and stuff. And it's like beautifully shot. Like, it takes place in like this grim like winter landscape and stuff, but Raimi just like frames the shot so well, and it's really well acted. Like, it's one of Bill Paxton's best performances, and it has, I think, probably the best career performance from Billy Bob Thornton. Like, it's a type of character I've never seen him before. He plays like this really like innocent simpleton type of character who seems like he's pretty dumb, but as the course of the movie goes along, he seems to be the smartest character out of all of them, and there's some times where he'll come up with like good ideas that save their asses completely by surprise and stuff. And I actually think he got an Oscar nomination for this. I think this film should have gotten more Academy Award nominations the year it came out, but unfortunately it didn't. But I was just delighted by it, because Sam Raimi, this was him finally getting kind of mainstream acceptability in showing that he could do like a serious drama and actually get nominated for awards and stuff like that. So it was really cool just to see his range, because you can't really know how someone's going to react to this, because if you're a fan of like Army of Darkness, then you may not like this film just because it's pretty depressing, like, to be quite honest, but you're not going to feel like a feeling of ecstasy like when you watch like Army of Darkness. But it's really well made, and it's definitely one of my favorite films from Raimi, and shows that the man does have a lot of range as a director.
Yeah, I heard that this was the real sort of turning point where he started to become more of a, I guess you could say, quote unquote, serious director. it's something sort of in line with the Coen brothers in a way. I just realized, speaking of the Coen brothers, that we actually skipped over a couple of properties that Raimi wrote but didn't direct that I wanted to briefly mention, one being The Hudsucker Proxy, which he co-wrote with the Coen brothers. Robin, what do you think of The Hudsucker Proxy?
I like this movie quite a bit. This is a movie that kind of I had to warm up to over time. Like, the first time I saw it, like, I thought there were individual moments in it that were just brilliant, but I thought the film was kind of a mess overall. It was kind of, like, all over the map. But as I've watched it more and more, I've grown to appreciate it more, because even though there are parts of the movie that don't work, this movie just throws, like, so much at the screen at so many times that there's just so much that really does work. And watching it, I almost feel like that crime wave was kind of a warm-up for this movie, him and the Coen brothers making it together, and this is their attempt to do it properly. But I love, like, the real zany moments to it, and, like, the fast, hard-hitting dialogue, and just, like, the random bits of comedy. Like, I think my favorite moment in the film is where, like, Paul Newman is going to, like, fall out of a window, and then Tim Robbins has to grab him, and his stitches in his pants are about to tear so that he falls, and then they do a flashback to, like, Paul Newman's tailor, where he keeps telling him that, "No, I keep telling you more and more, I do not want an extra stitch in the pants." And then they cut to the stitches breaking and stuff, and, like, Newman is just terrified, like, "Oh no, that decision of mine is going to kill me." And then they cut back to the tailor saying, "You know what, I like Mr. Musburger, I think I'm going to give him an extra stitch anyway." And then they show the extra stitch, which winds up saving his life. It's like, moments like that are just so brilliant and totally make the film. And that's what I like about The Hudsucker Proxy.
Oh yeah, those moments are pretty brilliant, I gotta say. This is, The Hudsucker Proxy is a film that I've actually always really enjoyed from the first time I saw it. It's a film that, I remember when I first heard about it, I thought that it was my friend Steve who told me about it. I thought he was crazy. Like, it sounded like an insane movie, because he was saying, "Have you ever seen this movie? I only ever saw it on TV, but it culminates and there's a fight scene between a guy who lives in a clock tower and an evil janitor, and they have a fist fight. And during the fight, the janitor or the clock keeper stops the clock, and it stops all of time." He told me this. I was like, "What are you talking about? I have to see this movie." So I looked it up, and I was delighted to see that it was the Coen brothers and Sam Raimi. And I was even more delighted when I watched it, because this is sort of like the same style of humor as a film like Raising Arizona. Like, really wacky, almost to the point of being cartoonish. But if you combine that sort of wacky comedy from Raising Arizona with a Frank Capra movie, that's what you'd get with The Hudsucker Proxy. Because it's, everybody talks with that fast transatlantic accent, like you'd hear in His Girl Friday. And all the humor is very rapid fire. There's a lot of dialogue-driven humor. But it was made in the 90s, so it looks a lot more polished. And it flows really well. I love the story, the idea of the guy who invents the hula hoop and inadvertently gets made into a patsy by the owners of this company. All the hula hoop gags are really good, too, where Tim Robbins' character is at Norville Barnes, where he's trying to sell them on the idea. He says, "I got a great idea," and he pulls out a piece of paper with a circle on it, and he'll do things like look at it and then, oh, turn it like he had it upside down, or say, "You know, for kids," like that's supposed to make sense of it, and everybody thinks he's a total numbskull. And then, of course, the hula hoop actually really takes off. But I love all that stuff. This is another film with a great supporting cast. Bruce Campbell, of course, is in it, but it also has small roles for, like, John Mahoney, as who you might know as the dad on Frasier, as the head of the newspaper. I really love, this is probably my favorite role for Jennifer Jason Leigh. Steve Buscemi has a small role in it. And, of course, Paul Newman as the evil Sidney Musburger. He is just having the time of his life here. You can really tell that Paul Newman is enjoying himself on this movie by the way he's acting. So a lot of great, you know, Coen brothers favorites, a lot of great Raimi favorites here. I think it's an awesome collaboration, And yeah, I really like this one. I think this is a highly underrated movie, and one that I think is probably one of my favorite. I hesitate to call it one of my favorite Raimi films because he didn't direct it, but it is a favorite of mine. It's a fun one that I like to recommend to people who haven't seen it. And the other property from Before a Simple Plan that I wanted to mention was the TV series Mantis. Did you ever watch this series?
No, I didn't.
I watched this series. So it came out in 1994. I would have been about 11 years old. And I was 11 years old when it first came out. And I thought this was the coolest thing ever. Mantis, in other words, Mechanically Augmented Neurotransmitter Interception System. It's just, I mean, it is so cheesy. You can find basically all of Mantis on YouTube right now. And it does not bear revisiting. I remember thinking it was awesome when I first saw it on TV, but it is pretty tacky by today's standards. The plot is a paralyzed scientist builds an exoskeleton so that he can walk again, and then he uses the exoskeleton to be a superhero. It's sort of like there's a bit of Iron Man, a bit of Tony Stark in that, the idea that he's this super genius and he makes himself a suit to fight crime. What I find really interesting about this series, though, even though it's cheesy, I could see it having a cult following, but I don't think it's a particularly great show, and I don't think that it'll have the lasting power of a lot of other shows, but it's okay. I thought it was cool when I was a kid. What I find interesting, though, is that it's actually viewed as a really great black TV show because it has an all-American principal cast. Well, actually, not all of them. Roger Reese is a prominent white character in it, but a lot of the cast, Carl Lumbly is the star, and Gina Torres, who would go on to play Zoe in Firefly and Serenity, she was on this as well. But yeah, I hear that that was actually like really well received by the African American community. It featured racism was a major issue, and it says here on IMDb that Fox executives thought the racial focus of the movie, of the TV movie pilot was too grim and too realistic, except for Carl Lumbly, the African American actress from the movie, replaced in the eventual series. But apparently that pilot was very pro black and really sort of highly regarded because of that, though not by Fox executives. But you know, what do they know? I should also mention that it was co-created by Sam Raimi and Sam Hamm, whom you might know from his work on the Tim Burton Batman movies as a writer. Check it out as a curiosity piece, I'd say. The series is not very good by today's standards, but again, you know, you can see Sam Raimi's love of superheroes come into play here, and I don't know, if you're into like really cheesy science fiction, maybe you'll like it. It also, the tone of this show, while it is a lot darker, just the look of it and the look of the quality of the special effects very much reflect Sam Raimi's eventual work as a producer on Hercules the Legendary Journeys with Kevin Sorbo.
Oh, and one more non-directorial Sam Raimi film I wanted to mention is the movie Intruder, which I did a Robin's Underrated Gems on. It's directed by Scott Spiegel, his longtime collaborator, and Sam Raimi and Ted Raimi all have acting roles in it. It's basically a slasher film that takes place over the course of one night in a grocery store, and there's not a lot of plot to it, but it's got some really cool, gory killings and some genuine surprises and twists, and you even get to see Ted Raimi get his head cut off with a meat slicer, and Sam Raimi also get a meat cleaver in his head and stuff. It's a very, very underrated slasher film, so I'd recommend reading my Robin's Underrated Gems column on it and checking the film out.
After A Simple Plan, Sam Raimi, this was a confusing one for me. He did a movie in 1999 called For the Love of the Game with Kevin Costner. It's like a romance movie and sort of a baseball movie, but really more about the romance. This is one that I watched like long after it came out. I think I only saw it maybe in 2010 or 2011. And I only watched it because it was Sam Raimi directed, though he didn't write it. And I had heard, my uncle Chris is a very big Sam Raimi fan, and I had heard that the movie of For the Love of the Game was overall kind of bland, the little baseball sequences felt very Sam Raimi, and they had that Sam Raimi flair. So that is why I watched it, and I thought it was pretty bad. This was around the time that Kevin Costner, it was a couple of years after Kevin Costner had also made Tin Cup, which was his golf movie, and both of those movies were sort of like on either side of Jerry Maguire. And to me, it always felt like those two movies were really trying to capture this, the same sort of spirit as Jerry Maguire. And I just, I don't know, I never really bought, Kevin Costner in either role. I don't buy him in a lot of roles. And, so this was one that I had skipped over and I watched it. And, you know, even those little clever touches in the baseball sequences where you can kind of see Sam Raimi, I personally didn't think that those made it worthwhile as a movie overall. It's kind of bland. However, this is yet another Sam Raimi film with a pretty awesome supporting cast, including the likes of John C. Reilly, Brian Cox, Jenna Malone, I really like Jenna Malone, and of course, J.K. Simmons, who would go on to be J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man movies. So, I mean, it's not a terrible movie. It's just, to me, another Kevin Costner baseball sports movie that, specifically, it's a Kevin Costner baseball movie that's not Field of Dreams, so maybe you shouldn't really bother with it. Have you seen For the Love of the Game?
Yes, I feel that this is a pretty strong baseball movie, but a very lousy love story. Like, I really like the baseball scenes in this movie because I'm a big baseball fan. I thought he does a really good job recreating them, and I actually love the scene in the ninth inning where he's pitching the last three outs of his perfect game. So as long as they're focused on that, the movie is good. But when they flash back to Kevin Costner's relationship with Kelly Preston, it's just, it's quite a slog because both of the characters are kind of whiny and unlikable. And then you see Costner, like, he thinks his career's over and he starts to mope and sulk and stuff. And I kept yelling to the screen, get back to the game. So
yeah,
the movie's worth watching if you fast forward through those parts and just watch the baseball sequence. But otherwise, no, it's not one of his best films.
That's totally how I felt too. Is every time I was watching it, and you know, there'd be this awesome little clip of him like pitching it out or something, or you know, just these little moments where he's like focus and everything except for Kevin Costner and the batter and the catcher all go out of focus, and it's just like he's zoomed in, you know, he's narrowed his vision down to just those essential elements. That's cool stuff. I really like that stuff. But yeah, every time he cut away, I was like, oh God, more of this. No. Get going. Come on. They don't even give like John C. Reilly that much to work with so he could do some good acting. But, I gotta say though, he was born to play a baseball catcher because he looks great in the outfit, certainly. Yeah, and I guess that's really all I have to say about For the Love of the Game. It's sort of an odd duck in Sam Raimi's career. It doesn't feel tonally similar to anything else he has done. And then in 2000, he made The Gift. This is another movie of his that I consider to be highly underrated. I think that this is a really, really good movie. Much better than its IMDb rating would lead you to believe. Kate Blanchett is a small town psychic in the South, and she's asked to help find a young woman who's disappeared, and it becomes this really interesting sort of intricate murder mystery. And again, an awesome cast. Thankfully, a really good Kate Blanchett in the leading role, a really good actress in the leading role, which just helps accentuate all the great supporting performances as well. But basically, everybody in this movie is good. Giovanni Ribisi is good. Katie Holmes is pretty good as like the small town sort of beauty queen. Greg Kinnear, Hilary Swank, Michael Jeter, Gary Cole, J.K. Simmons again. And oddly enough, I really like Keanu Reeves in this movie. He plays a menacing redneck really well. And I found that to be really surprising as well. I think the script for this film is really tight, and I really like it. I hope more people have seen it since it first came out, because I remember it sort of flew under the radar for a lot of people, and I was really vocally championing it to a lot of my friends. I quite enjoy it. Robin, what do you think of The Gift?
Yes, I like this as well. I should probably do a Robin's Underrated Gems on it sometime, because it really is an underrated film. I still remember when it came out, the main reason it got a lot of attention was because you get to see Katie Holmes' boobs in it and stuff, and I remember they were leaking out stills from it on the internet back in the early days when they would do stuff about it, and it's still referenced, I think, in Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. This is the Katie Holmes' naked film, but it's kind of a shame that overshadows it, because it really is a really good, like, gothic thriller, and it's also co-written by Billy Bob Thornton and his writing partner Tom Epperson, and they're really good writers. I always thought that Billy Bob Thornton is really underrated as a screenwriter. He's written a lot of solid movies, and this is a really well-structured thriller. It keeps you guessing from beginning to end, and I love the Southern gothic atmosphere, and I agree with you. I think the entire cast in it is terrific, and that Keanu Reeves is surprisingly good as, like, a violent redneck. So I kind of like that about Sam Raimi's films, is he always seems to get good ensemble casts and stuff, and even though he casts, like, unconventional actors, like, you wouldn't think Keanu Reeves would be good in this type of role, he legitimately is. And it's a shame that not a lot of people have seen it, but this is definitely one of the most underrated films on his filmography.
And it's the one that immediately preceded his, like, shot into blockbuster stardom. While we're here, I was just quickly browsing through the IMDb trivia on The Gift, just for other talking points. And one of them is, this is a Sam Raimi trademark that we have yet to mention, but ever since his earliest films, the classic, his old Delta 88 Oldsmobile, has appeared in just about every Sam Raimi film, except for Oz the Great and Powerful, I guess, unless he snuck it in there somewhere that I didn't see. And, of course, The Quick and the Dead, but how is he supposed to get into a period piece? But, yeah, I've always found that really fun, too, that this is one of his little directorial trademarks, much like the Bruce Campbell cameos, that he's sort of kept up to this day. I believe the classic was in Drag Me to Hell, and it was Uncle Ben's car in Spider-Man. I don't know, just a random little bit of trivia that I quite enjoy about Sam Raimi as well. Do you have any thoughts on the classic? I know that in one of the clips of Crime Wave that I watched, they, like, actively destroy it by driving it off a bridge.
Yeah, it's true. I was kind of, when I was watching Oz the Great and Powerful, I was kind of hoping, yeah, I know this is like a period piece and it's in a fantasy land, but I was hoping you would find a clever way to work it in there somewhere, but unfortunately you didn't. But yeah, I always love those director's trademark where you're specifically watching the film and looking out for them because you know they're going to appear eventually.
I wonder if somebody's going to discover it, like, way in the background of the tornado or something.
Yeah, you never know. It's probably in there somewhere.
So in 2002, Sam Raimi jumped on the superhero bandwagon with Spider-Man, the first film in the trilogy that starred Tobey Maguire, which is now getting its own reboot. hard to believe.
Please.
We've come so far. I guess it's just been over 10 years. Spider-Man's really interesting, you know. It's fun to see Sam Raimi's trademark style, and he's clearly got a lot of enthusiasm for the source material, but as a precursor to, like, the big Marvel movies that started coming out, it's just really interesting to see sort of where the modern superhero genre started finding its footing. I'd say that the modern superhero genre really has its roots with Tim Burton's Batman film. It was sort of like the big thing that started the superhero trend, but certainly in the millennium, Spider-Man was one of the big kickoff movies along with X-Men. What do you think of Spider-Man, Robin?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know if it holds up as well as it should, and I think that may be because they have released so many comic book and superhero movies since then that are, like, a lot superior to it. Like, at the time Spider-Man came out, I thought it was really good, but looking back on it 10 years later, it's more of a conventional, like, traditional superhero movie, which is good by itself, but it doesn't really, like, elevate itself like something The Dark Knight or, like, Iron Man or The Avengers does, and I think that's only because the whole, like, superhero trend was just starting with this movie. Like, this was a huge blockbuster hit at the time it came out, which is why so many films followed in its footsteps. And watching it, it's got lots of enjoyable elements in it. I particularly loved Willem Dafoe as the Green Goblin, and of course, the introduction of J.K. Simmons in the role. I think he's terrific, but just watching it, it's probably because it's an origin story. It just doesn't have the same punch that a lot of other films do. I think that Spider-Man 2 is a lot better than it. But of course, my favorite scene in this movie is still the introduction of the Spider-Man, the idea that wrestling helped create Spider-Man. His his fight with Boonzaw, Macho Man Randy Savage, is pretty awesome. And the fact that they cast Bruce Campbell as the ring announcer who gives him the Spider-Man name is quite awesome. That scene is probably my favorite in the movie, but yeah, it's still a very good superhero movie, but not a great one overall, I think. But at the time it came out, I still liked it a lot better.
And let's not forget, this is one of the big launch points for James Franco's movie career. Yes. This really brought him into blockbusters. Yeah, you know, much like the first of Bryan Singer's X-Men movies, this isn't a great one to revisit. Spider-Man especially is a fairly typical superhero origin story. The special effects haven't aged well, but I think because this was mainstream movies finally taking superhero movies seriously and, like, actually giving them sort of a respectful treatment and giving them well-made movies, even if they were slightly generic, I think all of that really sort of contributed to Spider-Man's success and why I still, even if I watch it now and it's not as good as I remember it, I still have very fond memories of Spider-Man. Like, I still think of it as a well-made movie because this is almost like one of the movies that set the standard for all the Marvel movies that came after it. And much like Bryan Singer's X-Men again, it's a movie that has a really great sequel that I do think holds up. I think X2 holds up really well, and I think Spider-Man 2 holds up really well. It's funny, you know, it's the origin stories of superheroes. It's almost like we've just become bored with them. And, you know, the second installment inevitably becomes the more interesting one. I really like Spider-Man 2. I think I cited this on, if I recall correctly, on our favorite superhero movies podcast. Do you enjoy Spider-Man 2 as much as I do, Robin?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think this is one of the better superhero movies ever made, and I think is a big improvement over the original Spider-Man. And what I really liked about this is the way that it examines the character of Peter Parker, and it kind of explores stuff that you've never really explored before in a superhero movie, that when he's not a superhero, he's basically like a really struggling person, a youngster, because he's like got a job as a pizza delivery boy, and like he lives in an apartment and has trouble like paying off his rent and stuff, and I kind of like that. Like, he's not a millionaire like Bruce Wayne, and he doesn't have like unlimited superpowers like Superman. He's basically a regular guy trying to do the right thing, but he can't live as a regular guy very well, because even though he has all this fame and success, he can't do anything with it because he has to conceal his identity. And I thought that was a really interesting aspect of his character, and the fact that he wants to quit like halfway through and stuff, and struggles, and also finally has to confess to like Aunt May and stuff that he was partially responsible for getting his uncle killed, and the whole angle with Harry as well, where Harry is obsessed with killing Spider-Man and doesn't know that it's his best friend. I think that's really well done as well, and I also love Alfred Molina as Doc Ock. The character makes no sense whatsoever, but he's so cool. I even wrote about the infamous scene on crack.com where Harry basically says like find Peter Parker to find Spider-Man, and then Doc Ock decides to like throw a car at at him through a car window, which would have killed Peter if he was not Spider-Man. But of course, Doc Ock did not know that he was Spider-Man, so his actions make no sense whatsoever. But they used that scene because it looked really cool, like in the teaser trailer and stuff. So I think that's why they used it. But it's still a pretty fun character and stuff. And the movie does have a very good witty sense of humor as well. Like it has some hilarious scenes, I think. Joel McHale plays like a bank manager and stuff and becomes terrified when like a Doc Ock takes over his bank. He's pretty funny as well. So yeah, this is definitely one of the better superhero movies ever made and one of Sam Raimi's best. And it was just so satisfying to see that the guy who started out as directing low budget films like The Evil Dead was given free rein to do like a really great big budget, mainstream Hollywood blockbuster.
Awesome action sequences, great villain. You know, this is another case where it seems like in these second installments of superhero franchises, they always have the best villain in the second one because it's inevitably this, like, the yang to the hero's yin, the opposite of the hero. You know, Batman is this force of order. Joker is a force of chaos. And you can even get really literal. Spider-Man, you know, a spider is this little eight-legged creature. An octopus is an eight-legged creature. And they're both geniuses, but one of them's an evil genius. One of them's a good genius. That stuff, even you look at Superman 2, you know, General Zod is just like the evil version of Superman. And that's what makes him so fun to watch as a villain. And so, much like many other superhero sequels, Spider-Man 2, just, it's got a great villain. All the stakes are raised, you know, now Harry wants to kill Spider-Man, but he's best friends with Peter Parker. It's totally terrific. Which makes me wish that Spider-Man 3 had been better. Now, we've talked about this before on the podcast, I'm sure. I remember having this conversation on the podcast with you before, Robin. You enjoy Spider-Man 3. I can never, I always sort of get it wrong, and I think I say like, oh, you must love Spider-Man 3 or something like that. But you enjoy it, right? Am I right in saying that?
Yes, I do not love it. I think it's a very flawed and problematic film, but I do think it's worthwhile and does have enough stuff in it that does work. I will say that my perception of it is probably clouded by the fact that I saw it opening night with a really enthusiastic audience. Like, they were, like, cheering and applauding stuff, and even, like, the bad parts in the movie they were responding to well, like during, like, Peter, when he's becoming all emo and stuff, all those infamous scenes, they were like laughing their asses off. And even though, like, I don't know if a lot of those scenes were intended to be funny, just seeing it with an audience just made it very entertaining. But I mean, I think the film's biggest problem is that it tries to do too much. Like, it has like it has Venom, it has Sandman, and it has like the conclusion of like the Harry Osborn storyline. Like, they really could have cut one of these out of the movie, and they just tried to cram way too much in there. Like, Venom just comes in there like near like two-thirds into the movie. Like, they really didn't need him at all. But I always give a movie credit. I like it when it tries to do too much and fails, rather than when it tries to when it half-asses it and isn't ambitious at all. So like, even though Spider-Man 3 has a lot of problems with it, I still, whenever in the mood, would prefer to watch it again rather than Spider-Man 1, just because Spider-Man 1 is more traditional and generic and stuff, whereas Spider-Man 3, it tries to do a lot of things and a lot of things that do not work well, but it also does stuff that I think does work well. I think the first hour or so of it is pretty good and pretty flawless, and I like the way they handle the character of Sandman while he's in the movie, though I think they lose focus when they bring Venom into the storyline and stuff. But and the scenes where Peter goes all emo and stuff, like, even though it is pretty much laughably bad and it's pretty much Sam Raimi like giving the middle finger to the studio for making him do all this, it's still kind of weirdly entertaining to me. And I think it's maybe the knowledge that Sam Raimi is just doing this to fuck around kind of makes it more entertaining to me. So even though Spider-Man 3 is very flawed, it's not boring. So I still have no problem putting it on and watching it today. Like, each time I watch it, there's like the big scenes in it kind of come apart, and there's a lot of stuff wrong with it, but it still somehow manages to entertain me. And and I should mention one thing, even though this movie is kind of universally regarded as a bad movie, it actually does have a 61% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, surprisingly enough. So its reviews weren't that bad. I think it's one of those movies kind of like the Star Wars prequels, where over time people just learn to hate it more and more, but it really isn't as bad, I think, as everyone says it is.
I think a lot of the vitriol I spew about Spider-Man 3 comes from disappointment. I was such a fan of Spider-Man 2. You know, it was like you were saying before, Robin, about, you know, Peter Jackson being handed Lord of the Rings. Sam Raimi being given Spider-Man, it felt like sort of vindication. Like, I've known this guy was a great director since the early 90s. But, you know, over the course of 10 years or so, somebody finally caught on and decided to give him a big franchise. And Spider-Man 1 was pretty good, but Spider-Man 2 knocked it out of the park. And so I was just hyped for Spider-Man 3. I couldn't wait. The trailers made it look really awesome. And then I went and saw it, and it wasn't awesome. It was pretty dumb. And I realize now that a lot of that was really intentional stupidity, because the studio wouldn't let Sam Raimi do what he wanted. I think he wanted to make the movie just about Sandman, which even that is a kind of a confusing choice. But, you know, maybe he was like hoping for a fourth movie or something. I know that there was one in the works for a long time. But yeah, the studio wanted to shoehorn Venom in because he was a fan favorite. But there are just so many puzzling choices. And it's those things that are really frustrating to me. Like, for example, I mean, it obviously makes sense to have the final confrontation between Peter Parker and Harry Osborn. They were building up to it over the course of three movies. But then they do this whole, like, soap opera-style amnesia storyline. And I kind of, like, obviously it is Sam Raimi's being like, ha ha, you know, okay, you want me to do that? Do some easier formulas? Oh no, a character has amnesia, you know? Oh God. Oh, it's so dumb. It's there's a love triangle, a new love interest. Ooh. It was all so poorly handled, in my opinion. But, what puzzles me about it is that the stage was already set for all of these different, you know, ideas. Like, why even use Sandman? Why not use Dylan Baker, Kurt Connors? Fans of the comics know that Kurt Connors becomes the Lizard. They even used him as the Lizard in The Amazing Spider-Man. And they'd had Dr. Connors in the film since the second one. So why not have the third one be him turning into the Lizard? You've got the character right there. Or, for example, I know I'm not the first person to say this, but I was wondering why they didn't make John Jameson, J. Jonah Jameson's son, who's an astronaut, why didn't they make him Venom? He had a lot of great reasons to be angry at Peter Parker. Peter Parker stole his girl, like, right off the altar. It was so confusing to me. And, I don't know, it is really funny to watch now, because it feels like almost like an Andy Sidaris movie, or like The Room, or The Wicker Man. You know, these levels of camp, it goes so far over the top at times that you kind of go like, what the hell is going on? Like, there are a lot of musical numbers in Spider-Man 3. Peter Parker goes all emo and he dances around like he's John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. And then he does that dance number with Bryce Dallas Howard at the, I guess it's like a jazz bar. There's the scene where Harry and Mary Jane turn up the chubby checker and dance around the kitchen to Let's Twist Again while they're making food. And it goes on for way longer than it should. I don't know. It's all so confusing, but in my heart, I like to believe that Sam Raimi was doing it intentionally. And you know, his follow-up to Spider-Man 3 might leave me to believe that, but after seeing Oz the Great and Powerful, I'm not so sure.
I should mention my favorite FU moment is when he finally has Harry's butler show up at the end to finally say to Harry, "Oh, by the way, I found your father, and Spider-Man didn't kill him, but I neglected to mention this the past two movies, even though you were slowly going insane."
Ah, God damn it. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you make the new iteration of the Green Goblin look so blatantly like a snowboarder? Like, why would you do these things? It makes no sense. You know, and you've got, sure, you don't, clearly Sam Raimi didn't want to put Venom in the movie, but if you're going to put him in the movie, like, he could be a really interesting character. He is literally the evil Spider-Man. You know, Doc Ock is a good foil for Spider-Man, a good opposite for Spider-Man, but Venom is literally the evil Spider-Man. And the idea of Spider-Man being corrupted by this evil suit, which is, they feature prominently in the trailers, and it was really exciting in the trailers, but that idea could have gone so far, and it was just this was a big miss. And I remember, again, this is probably has to do with why I dislike it so much, I remember waiting like 2 hours at the theater on the opening night to see this movie, and coming out of it and just being like, what the hell was that? I had no idea what had happened to me. Evil Peter is just a guy who eats a lot of cookies? Like, Evil Peter, he does some bad things, but he is not really Evil Peter. He's just more like pissy emo Peter, and it does not work for me.
What kind of audience did you see it with? Like, were they reacting to it and, like, laughing at stuff? Like, do you remember?
To a degree, but it seemed to be a lot of confusion. Like, mm-hmm. For the first half of the movie, there was a lot of, like, murmuring in the theater. And then the second half, people just started laughing, but it was not with the movie. They were laughing at the movie because it was being kind of dumb. But I gotta say, though, this is another kind of perfect movie for a riff track. I highly recommend. Have you watched it with the riff track, Robin?
Yes, the riff track for it is great. It actually enhances the enjoyment level of the movie if you're watching with the riff tracks.
Yeah, that's sort of how I feel about it too. Because, you know, the movie is silly and in my opinion is quite dumb at times, but at least it's visually interesting. Like, it's not a totally boring movie. There are some parts that drag, like that twist and shout scene. Or let's twist again, rather, in the kitchen. There are parts that drag a little, but it is not. It still has a certain energy to it. It's not an extremely boring movie to watch, and with a riff track, it's actually a lot of fun. there are a lot of really good parodies, too. If nothing else, there are a lot of good parodies that came out of this. I know How It Should Have Ended, I believe, did a great ending to this one, where they have a parody scene where, you know, Aunt May turns up, Peter's like, "Aunt May, what are you doing here?" And she goes, "Oh, I just remembered a long and boring story about your uncle, designed to make you feel bad yet again." And yeah, at that point in the franchise, that's really all the only purpose Aunt May serves anymore. But I don't know, not a total loss, but it really is one of the low points for me in Sam Raimi's filmography. Like, I even prefer For the Love of the Game to Spider-Man 3.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I'm really not a fan. But then he followed it up with one of my favorite movies, Drag Me to Hell. Robin, what do you think of Drag Me to Hell?
Oh, I like this movie quite a bit. Like, we've discussed this before about how we can complain about the way that, like, horror films today have gone more towards being PG-13 to appeal to a larger audience, but Sam Raimi demonstrated here that he can still make, like, a really good, like, PG-13 horror movie. Like, it works well, and, like, this time you can tell he's having a lot of fun with himself, like, returning to the genre, and I really love the situation, like, he puts his lead character in, played by Alison Lohman, how she's basically, like, a loan officer at a bank, and because she refuses to extend, like, the loan of this gypsy woman who is about to be foreclosed, she gets a gypsy curse put on her, which means she's going to go to hell in, like, 3 days after everything bad happens to her, and I just think that's so hilarious, like, how much bad luck a character can have, that they're just doing their job and they get cursed and are going to be sent to hell, and like, there's scenes where, like, after Spider-Man 3, I was wondering if certain scenes in this movie were supposed to be intentionally funny or unintentionally funny, but watching it, you can tell that he knows exactly what it's doing. Like, this movie works well on an audience. Like, there's some great set pieces, especially the scene where, like, Christine is, like, in the car being attacked by the gypsy woman and stuff, and, like, the dentures from, like, her mouth and stuff fall out of her corpse and, like, land on, like, Christine's face and stuff. It's just hilarious. And the scene where, like, they're doing, like, the whole ceremony to get the curse off her, and then this goat just suddenly starts talking and stuff out of nowhere. It's really a lot of fun, and then it builds up to, like, a very, like, unfair ending for the character, which totally fits, though, with the tone of the movie and Sam Raimi. It just shows, like, this kind of material in the hands of, like, another director could have, like, really turned this film into, like, a big stinker, but Raimi is just so skilled that he knows how to handle it and make it work, and it's a great movie to watch with, like, an audience and stuff, because when the scenes that are supposed to be funny garner laughs, and the scenes that are supposed to scare you wind up scaring you, so it just shows that he was, I think, after having such a bad experience with Spider-Man 3, he was happy to return to the genre that made him famous in the first place and take a breather, and he delivered a very good one.
Absolutely. The plot is like the stuff of Stephen King. The plot really reminds me of something like the movie, the story and the movie Thinner. But where Drag Me to Hell succeeds even more is, while the character played by Alison Lohman is, like, she's kind of despicable at times, and over the movie she does more and more despicable things, but when we're introduced to her at the start, it's made very clear that, you know, denying this extension on, to this Romanian lady, she was legally within her rights. Like, you know, sure, she could have cut the woman a break, but the woman had missed some payments and, you know, she was past due. And it's the kind of situation where, you know, she is just doing her job, but it's not even like she's making a bad decision on the part of her job. She's just doing something that is required of her. And yeah, it seems like the punishment does not fit the crime here at all. And that's what's kind of wonderful about it, is over the course of the movie, you go from feeling sympathetic for the main character to actually disliking the main character because of the lengths that she goes to try to remove this curse, which includes, spoiler alert, killing a cat. She, like, kills a kitten to try and break the curse, but that doesn't work. All that, you know, the stuff that she does, it ends up becoming pretty despicable. But again, spoilers, the movie's called Drag Me to Hell. All of that leads up to her being dragged down to hell, and it's really satisfying. It's like, it's almost like the inverse of a typical horror movie, where you start off thinking, not liking a character, but by the end you really start to like them and hope that they make it. Sam Raimi turns all that on its head and has a lot of fun doing it too. This is a horror movie that does not have to rely on blood and guts to get its scares. I love that all the scares are built through tension, and then the tension is diffused with these, like, sick, twisted moments of humor, like the one you mentioned where, you know, the gypsy woman's dentures get knocked out. So what she do? She, like, latches onto Alison Lohman's chin and starts gumming it. Or another moment where Alison Lohman finds the gypsy lady's corpse in a coffin at her wake, and the coffin tips over, and the corpse lands on Alison and like, pukes bile all over her. It is really funny and like, wonderfully horribly funny. That sort of Halloween haunted house kind of humor, where the scares are really fun too. There is a lot of great Evil Dead moments in this. In particular, one that stands out to me is where, I believe it's in a dream sequence, Alison Lohman drops an anvil on the head of the gypsy lady and her eyeballs pop out and fly through the air. Again, you know, very Evil Dead. It really is. It's like horror of the old school. And I hear that Sam Raimi actually wrote it very early in his career and only got around to making it in 2009. But I totally love this movie. I really, really enjoy it. And, it gave me a lot of hope after Spider-Man 3 that, okay, Sam Raimi still has it. He's still got the touch. He just has to be handed the right property. But yeah, as far as PG-13 movies go, PG-13 horror, this is one that I highly recommend. As a horror movie and as a comedy, like this is a case study in everything you can do right. I love every minute of it. Right up until the final shot, like every moment of this movie is just bang on, like really nails it. Oh, and there's so many fun things too. Gotta give very special mention to, Lorna Raver, who plays Mrs. Ganush, the evil gypsy lady. She is just so terrific. She plays horrifying so well. The entire sequence where she attacks Alison Lohman in the car, that whole sequence is fantastic stuff. I love every minute of it. Really is wonderful. Gush.
I always wondered the prologue about what Justin Long's going to do to explain what happened to his fiance. She fell on the train and then she got dragged into hell. And I keep thinking, yeah, he's probably going to go to jail for her murder or something like that.
Yeah, oh, man. You know, another thing I really love, too, is because of this great descent of Alison Lohman's character, Christine. You know, as I said, as the movie goes on, Christine gets more and more despicable. And eventually... She thinks she's got the thing that it's a button from her coat that has placed the curse upon her, and she's got the button and she has to give it to someone as a gift. And when they accept it, that will remove the curse. And there's this great scene where she's like looking around a diner and trying to think of who would deserve to die, or who could be written off really easily. She sees like an old man and she's like, I could just give it to him. He doesn't have long left to live. And then she sees that he's got an old wife or girlfriend with him. And she's like, I can't do it. That stuff's really good too. I champion the writing of this one. I think this is just a fantastic horror movie, which brings us to the present. And, as I mentioned last week, I was very disappointed by Oz the Great and Powerful. And this is a film where I don't feel it, the longer it goes having seen it, my opinion has not changed, but I've gotten a chance to read a lot of other reviews and listen to a lot of other reviews, like on Film Spotting and on the Slash Filmcast. And, you know, I've heard a lot of love for this movie, like way more than I expected. And I don't know, it's left me feeling kind of out of touch. I bemoaned on Facebook that I seem to be the only person who found the character of the China Girl, voiced by Joey King, to be just insufferably annoying. And it seems like most people thought she was really sweet and liked her. And I was even jokingly, I should say this was joking, but my friend Nick on Facebook was like, maybe you're just a heartless monster. I don't know. Maybe I am. Robin, would you care to reiterate your thoughts on Oz the Great and Powerful for any listeners who did not tune into last week's episode?
Well, I was not looking particularly forward to this. I was kind of like expecting it to be like another bland version of like Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. But I did like it a lot more than I thought I would. Like, I don't think I would rank this amongst my favorite Sam Raimi films, but I thought he told his story very well and that it looked pretty spectacular on the screen. It was visually satisfying. And I actually thought that James Franco was surprisingly good as the wizard. I thought he was surprisingly engaging. And yes, I did like the China Girl, surprisingly. I guess I saw it with an audience of kids and they seemed to like really react to her. And you could almost feel they were almost going to cry when she was whining about her parents dying or something. Though I could see how someone could find that insufferably annoying, but I thought it was a well-done character, and I actually liked the character of Finley, the flying monkey, surprisingly enough. I thought he was kind of an entertaining sidekick. So, yeah, not much more I could say. It's like I enjoyed it while I was watching it, and even though I don't think it was really necessary to do a prologue to The Wizard of Oz, I think he told his story very well. Though I did enjoy the theory you put across of it, that you suddenly realize that this is practically like a PG-rated remake of Army of Darkness, because you break the story down and the narrative is pretty much the same, and you could substitute the character of Oz with the character of Ash, and it's a very similar structure.
to reiterate that theory, in both Evil or in both Army of Darkness and Oz the Great and Powerful, a wisecracking, arrogant womanizer from quote unquote the future is transported to a fantasy land where he's hailed as the prophesied savior who's going to save the land from evil, who's going to fall from the sky and save everybody. And he vanquishes that evil using, like, modern, quote unquote, because modern for The Wizard of Oz is not modern by today's standards, but using technology and modern trickery and, you know, like, magic tricks, essentially. And over the course of this battle, the love interest goes from being this beautiful woman into this hideous creature. When Mila Kunis, Theodora, turns up as the Wicked Witch, the Margaret Hamilton role, in all her green glory, all I could think was, you loved me once, honey, you got real ugly. Because it really, like, it's, in terms of story beats, it is sort of beat for beat. All it was missing was an evil version of James Franco to turn up, and it really would have been an exact remake. But, I don't know. I found it very bland. I liked it only a little more than Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland because this one doesn't have the pop and lock Mad Hatter dance sequence, which I think just breaks that film. But I found it very bland, very CGI heavy, and I was really annoyed by the CGI sidekicks. Maybe I am a heartless monster, but China Girl and Finley as well, neither of them served much purpose to the plot. My friend Nick did point out, and I this went right over my head because I guess I'm just thick or I was so annoyed, but I didn't put together that China Girl was voiced by the same actress who played the girl in the prologue where he can't fix her legs. And I think the only reason I didn't realize that is because the girl in the prologue, I think she had maybe one line. So I just didn't even realize that it was the same voice actress because I wasn't given a baseline for comparison. And yeah, I get it. He can fix her legs in Oz with glue. But, you know, good luck going back and fixing that other girl's legs with glue. I don't know. It just didn't work for me. And neither Finley nor China Girl actually do anything. Like, you could remove them from the film and you would lose nothing at all. You wouldn't lose anything. And I defy anyone to prove me wrong on that point because they just don't serve any purpose. Not even really during the big climax. I don't know. There are a lot of moments I loved. I wouldn't say loved. There are a lot of moments I really liked. A few that I loved. Like, I did love the origin behind the idea of Oz being this massive face projected on a cloud of smoke, as we see in The Wizard of Oz. The origin of that, I thought, was very clever. But overall, it's just so problematic. It's very, very dull through and through. And the things I liked about it are just things I liked about Army of Darkness that did it better. One thing I should say, too, you know, also about the sidekicks is, you look at The Wizard of Oz, and there are a lot of sidekicks there, but they all have, like, a real reason to want to help Dorothy. The only reasons that China Girl and Finley the Flying Monkey have to want to help Oz are that he saved them. But with Dorothy, not only does she save each of these characters, I guess she doesn't really save the Cowardly Lion, but she spares him, quote unquote. Not only that, but they each want something from the wizard. They each have their own reasons to be on the quest as well. And as such, they become much more fleshed out characters. I just felt like these CGI characters, even though they were in 3D, they felt very one dimensional to me. But it's done really well. My opinion clearly isn't the popular one. And I'll be interested to see what follows, like if we're going to get more Oz films. I think they've already greenlit a sequel. So hopefully they start doing Oz films that are actually based on the Oz books. But overall I was kind of nonplussed. This felt very bland to me. But at the same time, I can't really complain because it's, you know, as recently as 2009, I have seen that Sam Raimi still has the capabilities to deliver a good film. And films like Oz the Great and Powerful, while I may not be a fan, its big box office earning is going to give Sam Raimi the power to do other great personal projects, that the stuff that he really wants to do. So, you know, there's that. I guess I can't really begrudge it for that. And that brings us up to the present. I mean, Sam Raimi, he's done a lot of producing work as of late. He's got his own production company, Ghost House Pictures, and they've produced some decent movies, others not so decent movies. I think I've talked about some of them recently. Like, I'm not a big fan of like 30 Days of Night or The Possession, but, I don't know. In a way, I am kind of a fan of the old Hercules series, and The Grudge was okay, I suppose. But I guess that covers most of Sam Raimi's filmography. Are there any other properties that you want to discuss?
No, just looking at his list of like films he's produced, it's like, wow, most of these are pretty bland. He's got better taste in directing horror movies than he does in producing them.
That he does. You know, I would like to mention that he's got a great little cameo in the movie Miller's Crossing as a gunman who gets shot up. I thought he was quite good in that. But yeah, overall, I think we've covered the big important ones. So now I ask you, what's your favorite and your least favorite Sam Raimi film?
Ooh, that's a tough one. You know, for favorite, I'm probably going to go with Evil Dead 2, and least favorite, I will go with Crime Wave.
Okay, yeah, since I haven't seen Crime Wave, it's got to be Evil Dead 2 for my favorite. I'm just going to go ahead and say Spider-Man 3 is my least favorite. I mean, Within the Woods is a difficult watch because it's so amateurish, but I appreciate Within the Woods a heck of a lot more than I appreciated Spider-Man 3. But at least Spider-Man 3 is a film that I dislike less and less the more time passes.
It's what not a film. Did you actually like, would you say you like it better than The Amazing Spider-Man?
Spider-Man 3?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about quote unquote liking it better, but I did say after seeing The Amazing Spider-Man that Spider-Man 3 elicited more emotion in me.
That's true.
The Amazing Spider-Man did. Like, even if I wasn't keen on Spider-Man 3, The Amazing Spider-Man was boring. Spider-Man 3 didn't bore me. It disappointed me, but it didn't bore me. And the anger I felt, at least I felt something.
Yeah.
which I cannot say the same thing for with Mark Webb's The Amazing Spider-Man. I think I've made it clear over the course of this podcast, but in case I haven't, Evil Dead 2, my favorite Sam Raimi movie. And yes, Spider-Man 3, my least favorite. Is there anything else you want to touch upon in Sam Raimi's career? I feel like we've covered it pretty well.
Yeah, I think we've pretty much covered everything he's ever done, practically.
So, you know what that means? It's time for the dumb joke of the week. What do they call the Hunger Games in Japan? Battle Royale with cheese.
Aw, I knew that was coming.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at the back row. Email Robin at robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out Robin's regular features, Robin's Underrated Gems, and Before They Were Stars, and of course all the work he does at cracked.com, including some work critiquing Dr. Octopus's plans. I write every day at the back row. You can reach me by emailing gil@the-back-row.com. Thanks so much for listening. Workshed! Music for today's podcast comes to us courtesy of the Back Row's webmaster, Michael. You can contact Michael through the Back Row, the-back-row.com.